Coming to you live from my apartment, it's Rob Has a Podcast. And now, here's the guy whose next long-distance dedication is going to be a note to self. I am Rob Cesternino. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Rob Has a Podcast. And boy, are we going to close out the Survivor recap season with a good one for you today, because Christian Hubicki will join us on the podcast today, and very excited for this one. And buckle up. It's probably going to be a long one if we know Christian at all with this captive, hopefully captivated audience that we have here today listening to this podcast. I have not talked about this a lot, but we do appreciate it as you're listening. If you want to subscribe or leave us a rating and or review on iTunes, if you go to robhasawebsite.com/iTunes, we appreciate it. I'm getting jealous of myself in that our Game of Thrones podcast is doing so well. I'm like, hey, what about Rob Has a Podcast, as I am going back and forth being competitive with myself. So I appreciate that so much. Of course, we had a great show last night on the Know It All. Steven and I got into everything as we were together for the last time. For this season, I will be at the finale coming up, and Steven will be with Hannah on Wednesday after the finale. We've got Mike Bloom coming up. Get your feedback questions in. That's always a great one at the end of the season with Mike Bloom, and Shannon Gates coming up as well over the weekend. So lots of great stuff. Plus our amazing race coverage, talking about episode number 4 of the reality showdown of Amazing Race. Before we get Christian on the line, let me just take a moment and thank our sponsor for today's podcast. This is going to be the only time we're going to stop the whole way through to talk about a sponsor. Those are friends over at Hunt a Killer. Hunt a Killer is the escape room like game, which brings the escape room to you. Because if you love the thrill of the escape room and like solving puzzles, well, now you can do it at your house, because Hunt a Killer is going to be your new favorite obsession. Hunt a Killer is the monthly subscription game where you become a detective immersed in a murder mystery. And each month you'll receive crime scene photos, evidence, motive, and suspect information that you'll need to solve a crime. I've gotten to play the game. It's really fun. You open up the box. There's a folder with all these photos and clues and real things that you hold in your hands. You go online, you look things up, and you feel like you are on the trail of a murderer. It's a great idea if you are looking for something to do on your own, on a date night with friends. Very fun to do, and you don't have to go to these expensive escape rooms, and then you go out there and it's like $30 a person, and then you gotta wait to get a time, and if you've done it once, that's it. This is an ongoing game that you get to play. Hunt a Killer. It's a lot of fun. So go ahead and give it a try. Over 60,000 people have joined the Hunt a Killer online community, and they have over 1,000 five-star customer reviews. Right now, for our listeners, you can go to huntakiller.com/Rob for 20% off your first box. They only accept 200 members a day, so hurry up and take advantage of this offer. That's at huntakiller.com/Rob for 20% off your first box at huntakiller.com/Rob. See if you have what it takes to get into the mind of a serial killer and solve the mystery. All right, everybody, I'm very excited for our feature presentation today, and I had been looking forward to this one for almost a month. From when I was in Philadelphia, I got the word from our guest today that he was up for doing a recap this season. I didn't think we were going to get him, but I'm very excited to have him here, of course, from Survivor, David versus Goliath. Here he is, the great Christian Hubicki. Christian, how are you?
I'm fine, Rob. I'm not sure I can follow. That's quite an introduction. I appreciate it. And it's great to be here. It's yes. Great to talk about a season that you're not on. Mm-hmm. That's a, you know, it actually for a long time, before I was even in contention to be on the show, I was trying to think, like, how can I eventually get on Rob's podcast? What is the way to do it? It turns out the easiest was just to get on the show.
Yeah.
That was the most direct, straightforward. But now I get to actually sort of live that part of the dream, which is talking talking about a season with you where I don't have, you know, direct personal stakes attached to it. So that's nice.
Good. Well, I'm really excited to pick your brain and talk about everything that's going on here in season 38 and anything else that we are going to get into along the way. We have not been on a podcast together since your deep dive following the end of Survivor David versus Goliath. What a day, a podcasting highlight for me. I think that 2 days after the end of the season, you came here sometime around like 7:30 in the morning. And
yeah, that's right.
The earliest I've ever gotten started here with a guest in the studio. And we went for hours on end. And I don't know if the listeners know this. I had sent you this message, but that is the most downloaded episode in the history of Rob as a podcast.
That is quite a compliment. I appreciate. Thank you, Mom, for downloading that 20,000 times. I really thank you for goosing the numbers. Actually, it'd probably be my dad. My dad, you know, he messages me about the podcast all the time. It's like, oh, did you hear the one with Coach? Did you hear that one?
I didn't know that your dad listens to the podcast.
Well, he does now. He's into it. He's really into it. And so I'm like, so he's given me the highlights even before I get a chance to listen, which is, you know, which is useful and get a perspective from him. No, he's totally into it now.
Is it because of you being on the show, or was your dad a fan of Survivor prior to all this?
Oh, he was a fan of Survivor prior to all of this as well. Like we watched together. I remember when we started watching the show back in 2000 when it started. I think I was in early high school, and I was coming back. It was in the summer. It was airing in the summer at that point. And two episodes had just aired, and my dad was driving me home from summer camp. And on the radio, they mentioned the show. And he's like, "Yeah, Christian, did you hear this show? It's like they're on an island. You know, maybe we should watch it. It's on tonight. Maybe we should watch it." I'm like, "Oh, sure." And so that was the first episode we watched, and we always watched as a family. And when I went off to college, and this is, you know, pre-streaming video, my parents would do the thing where they would do VHS recordings of the tapes, and they would record them all. And when I come home for like fall break, we would just marathon them all. And so it was with my family that we'd watch all this time. But I don't think my dad was a podcasting guy prior to this, but I think that now me being on the show sort of introduced him to this whole world of podcast commentary. He's really into it.
And was that a season one, episode one that you guys heard about that you jumped into?
Yeah, it was season one, episode 3.
Yeah,
was when we jumped in. So, like, I said
Stacey
at one
Stillman.
Point that I Stacey Stillman Boot. Right. That's the little amusing story. I remember I would tell this story to casting when I was interviewing. So I was talking to the casting directors, and you know, like, how this is how I got into the show. And I accidentally instead of saying Stacey Stillman, I said Stacey Powell, your favorite.
Blam.
And blam indeed. And they were very confused.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh no, I blow my chance on the show. I'm not going to get on now.
Yeah. Well, so, I think she might be kind of like a Voldemort type of situation. So I think that they probably might be appreciated for you to mention Stacey Powell instead.
Oh, okay. That's probably, you know, that makes sense. You know, there were a couple moments. Yeah. You know, it's good. So maybe it was just sort of like an internal sort of censorship. It's like, don't mention that one. But yeah.
Okay.
So that's when I started watching was season one, like episode 3 with my parents. And it was always sort of like a family function. And I remember when I finally got the call, like they were interested in me, and I had to start getting the NDAs signed by all of my family so I could, you know, get them, you know, in order to move through the process. And so I had to call my dad. It's like, yeah, my dad, I'm gonna need you to sign it. Have you guys all sign NDAs when I see you on my vacation next week? And he's like, what for? And he's like, well, you might not believe this. And he just starts laughing. It's like, of course, Christian is now like in contention to be on the show. So that's sort of our history together. So yeah, he's been into it. Now he's listening to podcasts.
Yeah, that's really wild. So you did not tell your dad that you were planning on applying to be on the show?
Not really. I think I mentioned once a long time ago, and he was really tickled by it. But it was years ago, and I had like heard nothing, and I never wanted to like let them know, because then they'd probably ask like, "So, Christian, did you hear anything back from the Survivor?" And the answer would probably always be no. Mm-hmm. So they wouldn't be, you know, so interested as to ask, and then I'd be reminded of my failures. That I would just like, "Oh, just let them know if I ever found out." And sure enough, Eventually, we had this fun conversation.
Okay.
Yeah. But then, yeah.
Christian, let's get into a little bit of what's going on here with the Edge of Extinction. We are less than a week until the winner of the Edge of Extinction is crowned. Finale coming up on Wednesday. And I am very interested to pick your brain here today, because you were telling me right before we came on the podcast that you have been a little bit outside of the podcast echo chamber in terms of sort of the ongoing analysis of the season. So I'm very curious to hear your fresh perspective on everything. And maybe it's not so fresh. Maybe it's exactly the same types of things that we have been saying in the podcast echo chamber.
Well, that's the beauty of it. I have no idea if I'm being hyper contrarian or hyper, you know, agreeable. I don't know.
Or hyper frenetic. So that
or hyper frenetic person like me. Yeah, exactly. So that's thank you. All right. That's a pleasure to hear. So yeah. So my overall take on the season, I was thinking about this throughout the whole course of the season going forward. And I like my overall take is that this is the most aggressive experiment that Survivor's ever done with their show since Blood versus Water, if not the entire running history of the show. Very clearly, like in terms of rapid departure, radical departure of format, this is bold. This is bold new territory. And we're learning and with kind of like a good bold experiment, you're learning a lot about what the show is capable of delivering on and what it has a hard time delivering on. So, and that's the way I view it. It's like, oh, wow. Okay. Things that you would never see before, for instance, on Survivor are a person wallowing the next day after being voted out. It was on Redemption Island. On Redemption Island, you would kind of see that. But they were then again, they're about getting ready to compete the next day on like a Redemption Island duel. So that was a little different. But here you get like a real profile of what it's like after you voted out. That's not something you would typically see. And so we're like, okay, that's a new thing the show adds. Same time we have, with the finale coming up next week, and there are 16 people in contention, right? 16 people that talk about a radical departure of format. I know I'm not breaking any news on that, I see you've practiced that. That's good. You're perfectly in tune. Yeah. So there are 16 people in contention, and that is what a hard and ambitious story to have to balance.
You need a bracket
for it. Yeah, the thing is, it would be like a bracket, but no one gets eliminated until the final, you know, that's sort of like the final four. Mm-hmm. That's the way I think it would work out. But so I don't know if that's breaking any news. I mean, but that's the way in terms of my opinion on it, I'm really glad that the show is willing to take a bold step like that. And so I'm like 75% okay with a lot of this. And 25% is like, how did you think that was going to work? What was the thought process behind some of the decisions? I wonder if they expected 16 people would still be in contention right now.
Yeah.
I honestly wonder that. Because it's probably, frankly, miserable out there for those guys. I mean, already it already stinks enough to be voted out, but at least there's some finality to being voted out. At least that's how it feels. Like, okay, that was my Survivor story. That's what it was like. Instead, now the players, they have a chance to get back in, which a lot of us would kill for. I mean, we'd all kill for the chance to be able to come back and get a chance to win. But at the same time, you're hanging out there for weeks, and and it's not like, it's different than Redemption Island, where in Redemption Island, you would be knocking out your competitors. You'd have Matt Elrod, right? You're like, he knocked out another person. He's one step closer. His odds are increasing with every passing day of getting back in that game. So it builds that sense of hope for him and perhaps for the audience too. In contrast, you have Joe Anglim shows up on after the merge. He's there. And he shows up with Aubrey and the other handful that are still there from the pre-merge. And then you add on another person. So let's say you're Joe. Like, okay, I have a chance to get back in. So then there's another person coming. Okay. Now there are five people. Now six people. Your odds can appear to diminish over time as you're here with more people. It's like, you know, it'd be one thing if I had to beat, you know, if I had to beat Stacey Powell in a one-on-one in order to get back in at the merch, blam indeed. And but now it's like I have to beat out a crop of what's it going to be? There are 16 people in the game. Almost certainly they're going to bring back somebody at the final five to make it a final six. So that means there are 16 people, five people left in the game proper, 11 people, right?
Yeah.
I mean, 11 person challenge to bring them back in. So that's a 1 in 11 chance at getting back in the game. Only then to be probably vulnerable for the final six and final five votes. And if history is any judge, people have been huge targets if they come back from any kind of Redemption Island based based mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
So, this is a long way of saying, geez, what it has to feel just so daunting to someone like, you know, even a challenge beast like Joe, someone who's traditionally a challenge beast, that, you know, look, I can maybe beat any one of these players on any given day 90% of the time, but I have to beat all of these players on a particular day. You know, I have to beat them all at the same time, and that's going to be hard. So I have a lot of respect for all those people on the edge of extinction right now that I would be interested to talk to to some of those players to say, what was it like? What was that experience of sort of hope? Were you hopeful? Were you getting more dejected? Did you think you're one step closer, or you're saying, "Hey, I'm on the show. I might as well embrace this camping experience while I'm here."
Mm-hmm.
So that's my thinking when I see Edge of Extinction. So like in a way, that's an interesting kind of character study. Unfortunately, you don't get a lot of time of that. You can't possibly get much time on the Edge of Extinction when you're also trying to tell the story of these half dozen or so. Somewhat active players in the game trying to, you know, outwit each other. And what has been a fairly dynamic game. There's been a lot of sort of changeover in sort of alliance structures. I mean,
I would just love to, I have some follow up on what you were just talking about with the Edge of Extinction. And I think, that you, really set that up in a very interesting way. Now, are you saying that you feel like that the Edge of Extinction concept would be improved if in some way that it was even harder, where it sounds like that when you talk about what the show had in mind, that I don't think that they imagine 11 people would still be in contention on the Edge of Extinction at this point in time. And so maybe I think that they thought more people would ultimately tap out, and that has not really gone according to plan. So should it have been even harder on the Edge of Extinction?
So I would hesitate to say that because here's an example from maybe the show's history. In Ghost Island, survivors of Ghost Island, they talked about how they cut their food supply in half because because it appeared that like previous seasons, they had plenty of food. They were able to catch fish and stuff. And so I know the Ghost Island people, they were really, I think if I remember them saying, like people like Kellen were saying how little food they had. And that's true. And they carry that over to David versus Goliath. And that was especially frustrating because in David versus Goliath, we had 2 weeks of rain. And when it's raining, it's almost impossible to fish and you can't catch food. So here's the situation where they might said, oh, people in the past maybe had it too easy in terms of food. And so we'll cut back their food. Mm. But then some random variable comes around, like the weather, and then makes it extra hard. And you're like, ooh, this is rough. Like,
yeah. That's a good point about the weather, where this is the even numbered season where historically, you know, during these last couple of years, while Survivor has filmed in Fiji, the odd-numbered seasons have been really hammered by the rain, and in the even-numbered seasons, that the conditions have been pretty pleasant overall. And I wonder, had it been worse weather on the Edge of Extinction, if we would have seen more people ultimately tap out.
I am inclined to agree that almost has to be the case. I mean, that's a very plausible hypothesis. I mean, like that you lose. I mean, I've said before, I know you said before, the rain is the most harsh part of the elements. I mean, it's not the hunger. It's not the thirst. You always access to water in some form. I mean, because if you didn't, there'd be no way to survive. But the rain, it just makes your entire existence miserable. Like, that was by far the most miserable I was. Like, it wasn't even like the hurricanes we got hit early on in our season. The rain came back out again right before I was sent home on day 35. So day 35 and day 34, it was just the weather we had just had about 2 weeks of beautiful weather. And then all of a sudden, snap, thunderstorms rolling back in. And then you're locked down in the shelter. You're being rained on right when you need the game to be as active as possible. Mm-hmm. So those random effects, they are big. And so, yeah, so we can explore this idea. Like, let's say hypothetically in multiple ways that this, Edge of Extinction happened on season 37, you know, like just, you know, a couple months before when they were filming, you have Reem, you have, Keith and all the pre-merge Edge of Extinction people, and they were just hit with two hurricanes.
Mm-hmm.
That is harder. I mean, like, it looks like Wendy, I don't know Wendy's story and why she left Edge of Extinction, but, you know, she left under reasonably good weather circumstances.
Yeah.
And she probably had her own reasons, right? There's no way she's sticking around during a hurricane, I can only imagine, unless she decided that, you know what, this is now a challenge for me to rise to. Maybe she comes to that conclusion. But yeah, people are going to be leaving. Yeah. I remember, you know, my castmates were pretty tough people, and it was rough on some of them being in that rainstorm. So, there's also the other hypothetical, which is not just like what happens if it happened during the time frame of 37, but what if you had like the cast of season 37 or maybe a season like 28, like a season that a lot of people really have reasonably fresh in their minds. You know, like what if you had an Edge of Extinction? I'd like to think of this sometimes where you had Garrett Adelstein, David Samson,
mm-hmm.
Jatia.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it was Cliff.
Uncle Cliffy, sure.
Uncle Cliffy.
Alexis Maxwell, Bryce.
Bryce, of course. Oh my God. I do like to play this game in my mind of not even just like, what if it was raining on Edge of Extinction? What if you took all the pre-merges from previous seasons? How crazy would that be? To be on, sometimes I think about that for my season, cause I know those players more personally better of what it would have been like to have Pat and Jess and Natalie
mm-hmm.
and Natalia, and
Lyrsa.
If she's still there, Lyrsa. Oh my gosh. Lyrsa. That could be a real, like, that'd be a real tinderbox of players. Typically in the pre-merge, you have a lot of the more, like you have people like Reem, right? And they stick around all season. They normally aren't around all season if they're first boot. And now you have her for the whole season,
mm-hmm.
which is, that is an entirely new experience. Even in my limited chatting about Survivor with some other people from the show, they talked about how that Reem being around all season is just such a new kind of phenomenon to have on the show. Anyway, I'm rambling a lot,
okay.
Rob. I appreciate you letting me follow through this, but yeah,
all right.
please direct me
in a
good direction.
Let's now go back to where you were going about the pace of this game as we have watched this really wild post-merge and are now set up here with five people going into the finale with somebody set to come back from the Edge of Extinction.
On the pace of this game, it is actually like when I'm looking at sort of the voting patterns, and I'm actually really kind of intrigued by them. I was when I was watching last night, and I was watching Lauren, and Lauren seemingly is in good with people like Gavin and Victoria
and
what appears to be some kind of new majority based upon what we see. And I mean, remember when she was part of Lesu, like the Lesu three, the people who were basically mm-hmm. dead men walking?
Yes.
And so I appreciate that sort of dynamic sort of element of the gameplay. The tough thing that can be in terms of a show watcher is that when the alliances change enough and you don't understand exactly why, that can kind of affect like, oh, it makes it harder for you to put yourself in that person's shoes and think about why they're doing what they're doing. And to me, that's really what's most engaging about watching Survivor. When it's most engaging, it's when you understand this person enough that you know what they're probably thinking, how they'll probably react to the situation, and that allows you to be invested in their decision making. And so when they get blindsided, then you feel it. It's a little bit like you got blindsided. It's like, oh no, this character, not only this character I like went home, but also this character that I was invested in their thought process. It's like I got blindsided too, because I was trying to, I was trying to think like them. I was trying to root for them. So on a sort of gameplay strategic level, like numbers on a page, I think it's actually a pretty interesting and dynamic season. These people are playing, I think they're playing hard. I think that they're all playing hard in their own ways, which I think is great. I have seen some people talk about the season that they're like, oh, they're not too high on it. That they actually think it might be like a real problem era for the season. I do see some Twitter commentary fly by on my feed, and people talking about how like, oh, this could be the like a dark time for the show.
Yeah,
I really want to kind of. When I hear things like that, I think back to season 24 and those eras in the early 20s where I almost want to be like, guys, it could be a lot worse, in my opinion, in terms of like how in terms of like the way the direction of the show. Because at that point, there was a point where Jeff seemed to maybe not want to do Survivor much anymore. Like, remember, he was like doing the Jeff Probst show at the time. He was busy with lots of other things going on other than Survivor. And so it wasn't clear how much longer Survivor might last. And it never seems to be. But there were things like there were challenges where Jeff wasn't there at the challenge.
Right.
But people can quibble with the concept, or I've seen people complain about the editing, which I do want to address, which I would not say it's a I actually really like, and we have to disentangle editing from like story choices or whatever. But like the team of people that are running the show really seem to care to me when I'm looking at the show, and you look at just some of the shots that they put together, like the camera crew is still so they're really stepping up their game. I think people have pointed out how on Edge of Extinction they do this their own sort of style of close up that they do that's unique to the edge, so that way they give you a sort of a visual sense you're in a different place. It's like a different sort of myopic atmosphere where you're looking where everything is just so much more internal at the Edge of Extinction. Like, you know, you're there, you're kind of alone. Yeah, you're with other people, but you are often told the story of these are the reasons why I'm on the edge. These are the reasons why I quote unquote failed. You know, you hear Chris Underwood talk about that. So it's very sort of introspective. That's really the word. Less myopic, more introspective, that your people are looking in on themselves. So you have these really tight close ups on them. So they have their game on. They have all the neat editing tricks we started seeing crop up in the last, you know, several months of the show. They're still popping in there. They're coming up with new ways to tell the story that's in front of them. So this is a long roundabout way of saying the show they really seem to care about putting on an interesting product, and they took a big swing. And so that's where I'm most optimistic about the show, that even if people aren't latching on to the plot lines in the way that they really want to, the core sort of enthusiasm of the crew and the people putting the show together seem to care. I mean, when I see Jeff talk about a new season, he's so invested in these concepts, like David versus Goliath. You ask him about the show, you ask him about the theme, and he doesn't skip a beat. It's like, well, David is this and Goliath is that. Like he's thought about this, or at least he cares about this. I mean, certainly, you know, not every person who was a David or Goliath, I would argue, was a perfect embodiment of David or Goliath, but the point was still there. He had this kind of story he was looking to tell, or some kind of question. I think that's really what it is. Jeff loves questions, I think. Interesting questions, such as how long would you go to the edge of extinction? and with such small hope of getting back in the game, would you just stay there for weeks? Mm-hmm. Would you do it? And that's the part of the show that really resonates with me a lot of the time. It's like that's one of the things that made me realize that this show was kind of an ambitious kind of show. I mean, because you could
easily
see
the season or Survivor.
Overall, the show, the season, all of Survivor. This season is an ambitious swing, and a particularly ambitious swing in terms of theme.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, I think that especially when it comes to the theming choices, I'm trying to come up with like a time frame. Because I think whenever Jeff comes up with like a new theme for it, I think he wants to really find some kind of underlying question to it. Sometimes it works out better than others. I think that, or like a neat concept like the Ghost Island. So whereas they could just not do that, they could just say, hey, Survivor's back. It's Survivor 38. And, you know, and it's just a new cast, which is fine. That might actually work out okay. But the fact that they are really pushing for some kind of, I think Jeff is pushing for some new kind of question each season.
Mm-hmm.
I think that makes me feel good about it. That makes me feel good about the health of the show overall.
Okay. Let's drill down a little bit further into where we are specifically coming out of last night's vote. And I thought that we had a pretty interesting final six vote. And we don't get a ton of final six episodes in the Survivor season. A lot of times that final six vote ends up being lumped into the, you know, first 40 minutes of the finale. And it got to breathe a little bit here in this season. Which I liked. And we had this very unusual dynamic where we had Rick, who was the target, and not just with individual immunity, but also with the immunity idol, where he was able to potentially bluff that he was going to save Julie. And then it seemed in my mind that another plan came together independent of Rick Devins with Julie and Lauren really at the core of, hey, let's keep our thing going together. And then Lauren was able to get Gavin and Victoria on board with going after Aurora at this vote. And I want to know if you had any thoughts in terms of any of the gameplay that really struck you in this final six vote.
So in the final six vote, I had the same read as you did, Rob, I imagine somewhat independently of Rick's pitch at this final vote that they were going to they're saying, hey, let's ditch Aurora, that they decided that for whatever reason, maybe she was more likely to be, you know, maybe more unpredictable than the alliance that they had going forward. And they decided to get rid of Aurora. Now, the interesting part that is pretty clear, at least from watching the episode, it could be construed by the jury that Rick was that orchestrated this plan, right? So you have this whole theater of what seems to be theater of Rick taking credit for this move, or at least receiving credit for this move. I mean, Rick is probably pitching for his life, you know, to change something up. I mean, I feel like I can identify at least a little bit with Rick's position right now, where he is, where people are saying, you can't take Rick to the end, you will lose against Rick. And sometimes people said that about me. And so I feel a lot of, you know, a lot of the thought process is when I'm putting myself in Rick's position, I'm like, wow, this is a little eerie, reminding me of some of my experience. Now, in terms of how Rick handled that tribal council, I obviously Rick is all in on, I think, immunity or bust, or idols or bust, I think is the name of the episode. Like he's kind of in the Ben Driegbergen spot. I think that that's pretty obvious from the way he's doing it. And the way this is that whole tribal council is like a long form manifestation of why you never tell someone they're going home, except now he's immune.
Mm-hmm.
So Rick's a guy with nothing, but he's playing with house money, as he said. He has nothing to lose.
Mm-hmm.
And he knows it. So he can make wild swings at tribal council, and he's free to do it. That's a dangerous position for all these other people to be in. And the fact that he's now in this position really crystallizes the game into a very particular state where it's where everyone is driving to get Rick home, or we'll figure out some other plan in case he's immune. So it's I remember there was a situation like this, and I'm sorry, Rob, if you bring back to my season.
When you were out there.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like I remember, and this is something that probably wouldn't be familiar to people who watch the show, but right before I was voted out, there was this rumor that Nick had two idols on my season, right? That made air. And when I heard that, Davey told me that, and I had to think, okay, like Nick could be the Ben Driebergen of this season. And at that point, Nick was kind of working against me. And I was like, okay, well, that's problematic. And I thought that the worst thing that could happen would be if all of us gang up on Nick and try to keep knocking him out and he keeps surviving. So I remember I had conversations with Davey and also Mike. And I was like, well, how do we handle this whole two idol situation with Nick? And we kind of came to the conclusion that we should just let him play these idols. And it looks like he's playing them, but we're not gunning for him. Now, Nick obviously had good backup plans. He manages to move forward and get to the end and win. So you know, this is all good. But this whole question emerged is, how do you handle a Rick Devens? Here's a guy who now may have an idol publicly, if you believe him. And two is probably the best challenge competitor left on the board in terms of record, and in sort of a variety of challenges. So how do you handle that? And the I think it can be a bit of a trap to say, well, everyone, let's gang up on him. Because then he plays like he has nothing to lose. And if he ever gets to the end, then it just completely just makes the narrative. Everyone wanted him out and he stayed. Mm-hmm. So in terms of how this affects Rick's gameplay, I think he's playing the game as good as he can in the situation he's in right now. I mean, he's in a situation where everyone has made it clear he is on the outs. So what do? You go look for idols. You try to win immunities. And it seems like there's some back pocket option he's trying to pick up with Julie. I mean, that's what you have to do. I mean, what else can you do at that point? I mean, I mean, you can try to be exceedingly creative in the strategic game to make people turn on each other. That's a very high degree of difficulty at this point because he's been around so long. The power of his potential story is so much. And now he's stealing credit for votes. I mean, now stealing credit sounds like that sounds more malicious than what it probably is happening. But really, he's getting credit for getting credit for moves that he didn't have to.
And
have
Aurora
to
gave him credit when she walked out. She's like, I can't believe you guys fell for that reverse psychology. And they didn't.
Exactly. And so that's the story in front of the jury. Now, all that said, I think this is all a bit it might be all window dressing in terms of Rick's overall chances of winning this game. I mean, when I put myself in the shoes of the jury, which is hard to do because they're on edge of extinction this whole time. They're not going back and pounding beers with Carl. They are all which is fun, by the way. And
yes.
So they're going back to Edge of Extinction, which is probably horribly boring. There's no Scrabble. There's no Rubik's Cube for them to solve, you know, whatever they're doing back there. And their most entertaining thing in their lives is coming to Tribal Council. And who is delivering the most entertainment at these Tribal Councils? Almost certainly Rick. So he is like a respite from all of that monotony, all of that nothing. And he came back from Edge of Extinction himself, which I believe people like Elizabeth have pointed out that that's kind of like validating of the experience of the Edge of Extinction people. If an Edge of Extinction survivor won. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a story there. And also, I mean, Rick's got friends there. I mean, you know, one of the stronger relationships we got on the show was the relationship between David Wright and Rick.
Yeah.
And he's there, you know, they're talking about people who are left in the game. You know, I'm sure it's all very positive about Rick for the most part. I mean, so I don't know how much it matters to Rick's game, in terms of the eyes of the jury that he appears to have been given credit for these moves. It might help the jury feel better about voting for Rick in case there's anyone on the jury saying, well, Rick got voted out once. Maybe how good is he? It's like, well, no, he did this great move. Mm-hmm. He convinced them at tribal council. And notwithstanding the previous tribal council, where I think I saw a lot of people give credit to Rick, the crazy one where Julia went home.
Yeah.
Where they all ran around. So in the eyes of all these jurors, Rick is a mover and a shaker. So it's a reason to vote for him.
Yeah.
A pilot.
Not a passenger.
Don't you love, it is kind of amazing, the small diversion, how each season kind of seems to get its own lingo, associated with it. You know, what's the meta narrative of this season? And that's, you know, a lot of groupthink can emerge. For our season, it's hard to, I mean, there was, you know, David Strong, Goliath Strong, David versus Goliath with a big meta theme that really creeped into the gameplay at the merge. There was also the notion of tribal lines blurring. Mm-hmm. That was our lingo. And it's completely understandable how there's like, oh, you're a pilot, you're a passenger. Like a passenger is now a pejorative.
You guys are playing like a bunch of passengers.
Like a bunch of passengers. Thank you, Natalie. Exactly.
Came up where Julia said, you're such a passenger, Rick.
Yeah, that was a moment. That was really played up as a moment too. I mean, like, and it's that's another thing this season. I'll get back to in a second, but how active the tribal councils are.
Yeah.
I'll get that in a minute. But like in terms of Rick and how he did this move, there's the effect on the jury, and it's also the effect on the other players in the game. I can't imagine how frustrating it would have to be like either a Lauren or a Victoria or a Gavin in the situation where you guys pulled together the vote. You decided to vote out Aurora. Aurora didn't see it coming. You did this move in your mind. And then Rick seems to get credit in front of the jury. Mm-hmm. Oh, that would just – that in a game where they're probably already frustrated because they can't get rid of Rick. And on top of that, but at least they could in their minds claim that, hey, I, Victoria, or I, Gavin, generally speaking, was on the right side of a lot of these votes. Like I was on the majority alliance for these votes, which demonstrates some kind of strategic agency that I think should be respected in front of the jury. And here, Rick now also can potentially take that mantle from you at the final tribal council. That would really rub that. I mean, not intentionally by Rick potentially, but that would rub salt in my wounds potentially.
Let me ask you this question and tell me, maybe this sounds crazy, but as we're sort of talking about in the big picture, how do you untangle the Ben Dreebergen, Mike Holloway situation where here's this person that we can't stop them. We're all against him and we can't stop them, but by way of they're winning the immunity challenges or they're finding the idols and there's just no way to stop with them. Would you say, and this is just blue sky brainstorming here, because we're talking not just to the listeners, but maybe future Survivor players that could be in this type of situation. Could you potentially say, hey, let's work with Rick Devins, because Rick Devins is getting all of his power right now by all of us being against him. And if we can't beat him, can we join him? And does he then seemingly have less power that he is part of a new majority instead of being the only person who is alone in the minority?
Ding that bell, Rob, if you wouldn't mind. I love that thinking. I think that I mentioned the whole situation with Nick before as being an example of that. That there was the risk of him being a Ben Dreebergen with two idols near the end of the game. And it's like, well, we can't all gang up on him because then I'll make him seem more powerful. Whereas, and of course, the risk is like, oh, in this case with Rick, let's say you welcome Rick back into the fold and you work with him and he gets to the end anyway. Then he can claim, look, I was on the bottom, but I worked my way out of it, right? That's the risk. And so he looks like a strategic social genius as a consequence. But when you open up another avenue, and I can speak from my own experience here, I was desperate not to be stuck in a situation where I had to win immunities or get idols to get down to the end. That was terrifying to me just because those are just so fluky. I mean, you can get a challenge that's just not – just really good for someone and that isn't you and you'll lose. Or you just happen to not – you know, how random is it whether or not you find an idol? Certainly it's not all chance. You have to go looking, and there are better ways of looking than others, in my opinion. But it's so random. So that's scary because basically you're someone like a Rick is probably desperate for a more stable way to make march forward in the game. And if you offer him that, I think that he'll take it. I mean, right now, Julie's working with him partly because it seems like Julie feels like she's on the bottom based upon what we're seeing. But if you now welcome Rick back in, where he is now part of this alliance, now he is just part of this group, just like you said, right? It sort of dilutes his strategic impact in those moments. And two, it can actually lull you into a false sense of security if you're in that position, that you're like, oh, now I don't have to count only on my idols.
Mm-hmm.
And think about what that means. Think about what that means in terms of practical life around camp. Rick is seemingly a political leper in terms of the way it's being presented on the show. No one really wants to work with him for the most part. So why not run around looking for idols all day and all night?
Right.
Now, so there's no cost to it. When you establish a social relationship to him, you now establish a social cost to going looking for the idols. It's like, well, you know, I don't want to burn my new allies by only looking for idols all day.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, we're all going to look for it to some degree. But right now, there's no cost associated with looking for idols. And a lot of Survivor is a balancing of perceived costs to your social capital. I remember when I was on Teva Beach, when I was swapped onto the group of five with the Brochachos, I was in good with the Brochachos, but not good enough that I could go around looking for idols very much. That if I got caught looking for idols, I knew I was sunk. That I would be a target. So that really prevented me from spending nearly as much time as I wanted to looking for idols. And any way you can convince someone like a Rick to not spend all day, all night looking for idols, is a win. I know that there are probably people watching saying, hey, why aren't you monitoring Rick day and night? I understand that. I understand that objection. It is also really hard to not, I mean, like if Rick sees an idol and you don't, he can walk away from it and then just kind of glance by and then go pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
There are ways to get around that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, last week he woke up in the middle of the night and climbed up on top of the shelter. I don't know how they could have stopped him from that one. I think that's probably getting a little too much of, okay, now somebody has to stay up all night and watch him. But it looked like until the very end of this episode, everybody's like, hey, where's Rick? Oh, he must be out looking for idols. Right. Should we watch him? Like, I don't know.
Yeah,
but if they were working with him, they could be in meetings all day with Rick Devin. So talking about
exactly. Who
should we vote out next, Rick? What do you think? Julie? Or Aurora? Or should, what do you think? Who do you think is coming back from the edge of extinction, Rick? What should we do next, Rick? What do you think?
That's a really interesting thought, Rob. You mentioned basically, you know, you booked up in meetings all day. And that's something that I didn't really appreciate until I was on the show, is that there really is a finite amount of time. I mean, that you're around to do things. I mean, that seems a little crazy because, I mean, what are you going to do for 39 days while you're sitting on an island? But really, especially when there are a lot of people in the game, I remember I was trying to find time to talk to every single player one-on-one. Right. And so at the merge, there are 13 people and the merge episode was 3 days long. So like I had 3 days and I only got a chance to talk one on one with Kara for like 30 seconds. There's only so many opportunities. And so really that means that your time is scarce. So where do you budget your time? You could spend it all your time looking for idols, or you can actually spend it around camp having these conversations with people.
Mm-hmm.
And basically sort of assessing, getting the lay of the land, making sure you're present, making sure that your allies don't forget that you're their ally.
Right.
That can happen. I mean, it can happen in the extreme for sure. Like when you have a swap, you start off your starting tribe, then you swap to some other tribe and your alliance partner's on the other side. And you can hope that you get back together, but you haven't been around each other for a week. And so you don't really know where that stands. So you have to do a good job reconnecting. But that can be true too, even just when you're on the same beach. I remember, especially when people have different standards for how often you want to talk to them. Like for instance, me and Gabby were really tight allies and we talked a lot. Okay. But when there was a point after the final 10 where we didn't talk as much for like a day or two. And you could just feel that the alliance felt a little different. It felt a little bit shakier. Now we basically repaired that pretty quickly. But we just didn't spend the normal amount of time with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And you can turn this actually, instead of just being a defensive thing where you're saying, hey, I need to budget my time appropriately during a day to keep in touch with all my alliances. If one of your alliance partners starts spending less and less time with you, it's possible that's a signal that you're spending more and more time with other potential alliance people, that they're trying to work on another kind of blind side that you're not in on. These can be signals that you can read. So you might say, hey, I haven't talked as much with this person recently. I wonder what they've been up to. That's actually a pretty reasonable metric for, you know, some degree of suspicion. Mm-hmm. You're like, okay, what have they been doing if they haven't been plotting with me? They're probably working out on a, like some real plan that they want to do at Tribal Council. Mm-hmm. And maybe they're only checking in with you for the fake plan.
Yeah.
That's a real potential signal. I remember Zeke one time actually said, I think very astutely, that your power in the game is proportional to the amount of times you are approached for conversations over the number of times you approach people for conversations. So wow. Basically, how much are people approaching you to how much are you approaching people? I think Zeke said that. I think that was very astute. Like, that's a good point. So if mm-hmm. you find yourself, you have to go be pulling people aside for these conversations.
Probably apply that to dating also.
I don't have much experience on that front, but yeah. I'll trust you on that thing.
I'm the expert?
Yeah, hey. You're the expert on this one. I think so. Yeah.
I am on ship. No, yeah.
What is a ship?
That's a different podcast sponsor dating app.
It's like as in ship. Okay, all right. My cultural references need to be brought up.
No
to date.
Problem.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah, you got it.
No problem. Very, very interesting stuff. My mind is sort of spinning now that we're talking about this. What if, hypothetically, like Gavin and Victoria, decide that, okay, here's what we want to do. Not only are we going to book Rick Devins up with meetings all day, but let's try to really throw him off where let's both try to separately tell Rick Devins we want to vote the other one out. They'd have to be, you know, confident enough about what they're doing. But Gavin is going to start working on Rick Devins. Hey, we should blindside Victoria. And then Victoria is going to start working on Rick Devins. And in the same way, like, you know, War Dog was going to go after I can't beat Gavin. I can't beat Victoria. And now that you get Rick Devins potentially, you know, throwing his vote somewhere else, and then they could potentially go after Julie if that was the target they want at this next vote. Instead of Rick having a lot of time to work out his plan about how he's going to go after this gambit to try to save Julie.
Yeah, I mean, you have to. Yeah, that might be an interesting way to like sort of filibuster his time, his resources, time based resources here on Survivor. Let's say really put out a dangle. And I think one thing that could prevent this in some ways, why it might not be happening, there are people. It's possible among the non Rick Devins folk that there's a group think that it's got rid of Rick, and if you're the one to speak up, then you could be in trouble. But you have to find a way to break that spell, where you say, hey, guys, Rick is a problem. You know, he's also in a position where he can win a bunch of immunities. We cannot put him in this kind of in this vaunted position as person who's being seemingly persecuted. And it's in the Survivor sense, in that, like, you know, you're the one who is being targeted all the time. That's in robotics, we would call this like absorbing states. Mm-hmm. It's a concept. So imagine you have a state of the game. This game that the game is in a particular position where, and it could be in all kinds of positions. But there are some positions where you're destined to lose. Or you're very, very likely to lose. It's hard to escape. Basically, you are absorbed into this bad game state. They use these concepts for making algorithms that, you know, try to win games. You want to avoid the absorbing states where you lose. And there are a couple ways that this happens on Survivor. One, I think Joey Amazing would be very familiar with. I call it it's kind of like the death spiral of threateningness.
Okay.
Where you are so threatening that the only way to survive each individual vote is to do something crazy, which makes you even more threatening. And so I call this like a threat spiral. I tried to call this out on the island, but like, but it didn't make air. But like the idea is that that once you become a certain level of threat, like almost the only way to get out of it is to be more and more threatening. But basically you pull some idol out of your pocket, use some crazy tribal move, and people say, wow, you survived. That's great. You're even more of a threat now. It's kind of like what Rick, I would describe Rick Devons as sort of in. So that now the only way to survive is to win immunities or idols, seemingly. The other way is that all the other players can force a player like a Rick Devons or a Ben Dreeberger into a position where they have to, where they have to win immunity to survive. So now the entire set of possibilities that this game of Survivor could exist in is actually collapsed down to comparatively few, where it's, does Rick Devons get to the end or not? And so how do you break that? And I love that idea of saying, well, we can't get into this state. This state is deadly for us. Either, you know, it puts too high of a probability of us putting being in an unwinnable position with Rick being in the best spot. So we need to make sure that Rick feels like he's part of the tribe. Like I said before, it's kind of like when you tell someone right before tribal council they're going home, and then they can do crazy things. Mm-hmm. But imagine that played out over like four episodes.
Yeah,
that's the way I think about it. But yeah. Anyway, so that's my current thought. That was based on what were we talking about?
The threats, threat spiral, and Rick working with Rick Devons instead of resisting. Yeah. Rick Devons.
Yeah. So that's all on that theme, right? So like that, so you don't want to push yourself into that absorbing state that you can't escape from, which is Rick Devons as the ultimate threat.
Okay.
You're really having one giant ultimate threat, unless you're really sure you can knock them out before the end, is probably a bad idea.
Let me bring in some questions, because we have a ton of questions for you here today as we go through this conversation. And Dr. Amanda Rabinowitz writes in and says,
I love Amanda Rabinowitz. She works on the Angie Kant's GameBot system.
Among many things.
Yeah. Yeah. Not to pigeonhole her. She has an actual academic career outside of Survivor. Mm-hmm. I know. So, but anyway, continue.
She says, I've been thinking about Christian's preseason interview with Wiggler during this season. In that interview, Christian suggested that part of his strategy was to introduce chaos into the alliance structure of the season, under the assumption that as a frenetic player, he would be most likely to capitalize on that chaos. I didn't fully understand what Christian was driving at the time, but now, having seen how this season played out, I can sort of see where he was coming from. This season has had very weak and chaotic alliance structures, with the same group of players seldom voting together two tribal councils in a row. The entropy of social game this season has allowed an opportunity player like Victoria to flip back and forth and always find herself on the right side of the numbers. And it has allowed a creative and risky player like Devons to play a flashy game that seems to be impressing the jury. Is this season an example of Christian's pre-David versus Goliath strategy? And what does he think of how the players in this game have adapted to the entropic season?
Oh, I love this question. It's
and
a great
PS,
question.
Congrats to Christian on his recent teaching accolades.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Amanda Rubinowitz. Dr. Amanda Rubinowitz, thank you very much. This is exactly what I was talking about. I mean, to a very close approximation, where all the alliances, she's putting her finger on this idea that people are voting with different people all the time. Something I didn't get a chance to do, but is very astute of her to point out. She called it the entropic nature or entropy. So, Rob, you probably have heard of the term entropy before. Am I correct in this? Or I can explain it for the audience generally.
I've heard it, but just for the listeners, maybe just refresh their memory.
Absolutely. No, I planned on doing it. I just want to make sure I wasn't just like explaining something you already knew. But yes, the idea of entropy is sort of this notion of disorder. It's a very sort of lay, simple way of saying it. It has a real actual mathematical definition, but sort of the amount of disorder that's in a system versus how orderly it is. So if you look at something like a crystalline structure that, you know, if you look at it like a crystal, if you look at all the atoms in a crystal, they're already very perfectly organized and aligned. And we'd say that that system has very low entropy. Whereas if they're all jangled and jumbled all over the place, then it's very high entropy. I mean, people talk about it like an organized room is low entropy and a messy room is high entropy. And sort of it's like a state of the universe. It's a fact of the universe that entropy in the entire universe will always be increasing, or at least never be decreasing. So this is important for concepts in what we call thermodynamics, which is the science of energy. So when you are doing energy production, you can't get more energy in than you can't get more energy out than you get in, and there's always an increase in disorder as a result of any process. So anyway, but where's this regard to the alliance structures here, that there's a lot of disorganization in that. What will be a very organized alliance structure? Let's go back to maybe Survivor Australia. You had a big alliance, picks off a smaller alliance. You have very organized. You have one big alliance, pick, not much changing there, very ordered. What's a crazy season? I would say Kagayan is a pretty crazy season. You have Tony bopping back and forth on every odd number vote. You can actually, it's something I always wanted to do, never got around to, use the mathematical definition of entropy, which correlates to information theory. And I would like to apply it, or have someone, you know, if someone else could do this, it would be great, because it's very hard to find the time to do this, but to be able to actually quantify the amount of entropy in a game of Survivor, and that if you use the mathematical definition of entropy, I would be curious if a really sort of dynamic and changing game would have a higher entropy value than a very ordered game like Survivor Australia. And so in terms of strategy, in a higher entropy game, the idea that I was going into was that if the game was crazy enough and everyone knew it was crazy and the alliances are going to change next time and then the time after that and the time after that, then you can't plan ahead. It's very hard to plan ahead. It's like predicting the weather, a month in advance, as opposed to a day in advance. Much harder to do. So, and the reason I wanted to do that in my game, because I was really concerned that people would say at that point, Christian, if he gets to the end, will win. That's a very forward-thinking, long-term thought process, which you cannot do if the game is chaotic. If the game is chaotic enough, you have to be able to consider the fact that, oh gosh, if I don't work with anyone I can, I might get voted out at this vote. This vote could be crazy. Julia could go home at this vote. Eric could go home at this vote. Who knows? It could be Ron Clark who goes home. And so if they're all afraid for their own lives, as I've often said, then that forces people to play a much more nearsighted game, a myopic game. And I thought that would suit me. And also the other aspect of this is the game moves really fast. The players who are most adaptable will have a relative advantage. So let's say you have a player that really wants to play alliance strong numbers, and the alliances are in fact really strong. Maybe it's like it is a Survivor Australia. Well, that really benefits that player. They are playing into the state of the overall game as it stands. Oh, it's nice and static. It's not very chaotic. I'm going to be loyal and that'll get me through. But in contrast, if the game is super crazy and that same player trying to stick to a very simple alliance, will be left in the dust. So, that was my thinking. And I love the way that this season is really embracing that. I think that it really speaks to the people that they cast on the show these days. In modern, what's called, I don't know, postmodern Survivor, in the 30s, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of these seasons, like I hesitate to think that, let's say we take these players that were cast in 38. They were up against returning players, and they knew that they could not trust the returning players down the line. Whereas whatever happened in Redemption Island, whatever the thought process was there, the players in that season were like, oh, Rob is basically telling me how it is. And it allowed Rob to do, other Rob, in case you're confused, Yes. Oh, I'm sorry.
Smarten up.
It allowed him to be able to manipulate that game much better. So I think that the players are much savvier, that they have either beaten into them, or I think more likely they know to that there might be a situation where they have to jump ship, and that's okay. A lot of people were like that my season. Not everybody. I know Dan was a very loyalist player, and Carl was quite a loyalist player. So we had more of a mix. I don't know who are the loyalist players. Like when I say loyalist, I mean like loyal IST, not EST. Loyal.
Well, Joe certainly was in that camp.
Yeah, yeah, and you know what? I wonder if that's a good point, and I wonder if that's something that didn't help him in this particular game set. By the way, you know, I did see something about Joe. I saw people making fun of the fact that he painted during his boot episode. Mm-hmm. I do kind of want to defend Joe on that point.
Please,
granted, I don't know the specifics of what went down on that beach, but I could certainly see why that would be a very smart and brave decision. I think that I'm currently of the thought process that sometimes the bravest decision you can make on Survivor is to do almost nothing. That's a very brave thing to do if you do it intentionally. Especially with someone like Joe. It's not like Joe, when he was on the bottom of Worlds Apart, you know, he made a fake idol to try to bargain with Mike Holloway in order to get him to stick around one more vote. And, or I forget exactly what the thing, but he worked his butt off to stick around. And Joe is not stupid. He knows that he is a big challenge threat. So I think he was trying to craft some kind of narrative that say, hey, yeah, I'm good in challenges, I can help you out, but really, I'm not a threat. I'm this loyal guy you want to work with. You can count on my vote. And that's what I think he was trying to sell. And at the merge, when the game is so crazy, to have the patience to sit around and paint, which I'm assuming, I am assuming this was an intentional thought. I'd be curious to, I wish I had all the unseen footage to see if he said at the time that this was his thought process. And it's also additionally brave. So it's brave in that you're putting your fate in your read of the current situation, the current tribe situation as it is. And it's also brave in that if you go home, you look really stupid. That is another thing that that's something that really crops into your thinking on the show. That, you know, if I go home because of this, will I look really stupid? I mean, if this was not a televised, you know, product, that might not be the case. So in a way, so I do kind of want to defend Joe on that point. Now, it's possible he's, you know, if we put, you know, injected him with truth serum and asked him, hey, do you just want to paint? He might be like, yeah, I just wanted to paint. At which point I withdraw all my previous points. But so I do want to point that out. That was
You're
my
in
thinking.
The camp, Joe was playing possum and was trying to basically look like he was not having anything going on.
Yeah, you said that way better in like 10 seconds than I did in like 20 minutes. So first off, kudos to you. Kudos to you. I should learn from you.
I did give him credit earlier in the season for things, and I got some pushback where I felt like that he was intentionally not being in the position to get like the last ring toss where he was switching on and off with Eric in one of the challenges. And I thought that he smartly seemed to position himself where Eric was going to be the one casting the winning shot. And I think that he did then in a secret scene confirm that that was something that he wanted somebody else to have the spotlight of being like, Eric wins immunity for
whatever they won for. I didn't catch that. I didn't catch that on the rewatch. And those challenges are good indicators of that. Now, I could be crazy. I don't want to be one of those people.
Was there tribe.
Comma tribe. Yes, yes, yes.
I love
and, comma. That's right. They had their song. I noticed they sang that a number of times. We did not have a tribe song. In fact, I just generally refrain from singing for the most part with minor exception. I did one at one point. I did try to do the William Shatner version of Rocket Man.
I saw you tweeting about this. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I did. Yeah, I was told not to do that. So I learned my lesson.
By producers or by your tribe mates?
I think the known universe, I think, was mostly against this. But yeah, definitely producers. It's sort of a thing, you know, you don't want to be singing copyrighted music on Survivor. I think, as I think you famously pointed out from Penner in Philippines, that I think Dana was sick. Mm-hmm. And he felt that the cameras were too close up in his face, in her face, and they were dripping water on her. And he was like, if you guys don't back off a little bit, I'm going to start singing the entire Beatles catalog. And I'm like, oh, that's funny. That's funny. So that was always in the back of my mind. That's something you could do.
I think he may have. I think
he may have actually did that. That's funny. I wish I,
Penny Lane cool. is in my ears, is in Dana's face. Yeah.
Now I'm on the spot to come with a better Beatles reference. I think I'd pull in Cochran for that. He's more big Beatles fan than me, though. So that would work out fine.
Okay,
but
still plenty of podcasts to go.
That's right. So consider this the Beatles challenge to Cochran, in which I'm not participating. So now I could be crazy in terms of the Joe thing. I don't want to read too much into him playing possum, but like to me, like if I were him, I would look for any way I could to not be seen as threatening or have people mm-hmm. forget about me. It's also quite possible that like he was so confident in his alliance and he was blindsided by that, which I think to some extent has to be the case.
Well, we've barely touched on the returning players here in this season, which has been a departure for a lot of the podcasting this season. Were you struck by the performance, good or bad, by any of these four returning players this season?
I wasn't struck by any like good or bad performance of it. I noticed a lot more nuance, I think, to how they played, which I think was very enlightening. This is my take. Like, for instance, Aubrey got blindsided with the idol. I am not shocked, and that's not because I think Aubrey's a bad player. I think she's a very good player. I think what this shows is that any player on Survivor actually has a fairly limited set of Survivor experiences. When I think about Aubrey's history through the game, can you maybe brainstorm with you, Rob? When has Aubrey been the target of like a secret blindside that she wasn't supposed to know about? Was it like at the only? I'm coming up blank on examples. And the only one I can think of is whether or not Peter Bagenstos and Liz Markham were trying to blindside her way back on. I don't even know if they were blindsiding her or not. Mm-hmm. Has Aubrey had to go through the experience of everyone is plotting against you and you're not supposed to know about it? I don't know if she has. Do you know?
I'd have to really go through Game Changers and talk about entropy season with a lot of entropy Game Changers.
Oh yeah, that's okay. And just really briefly on entropy. I mean, I find it intellectually interesting. It can make it hard. I fully acknowledge it can make it hard to be invested in the characters if everything is changing every week. Then what do you really know about their motivations? So that's a really tricky line to walk. Even if you were scripting it. I mean, you know, you have Game of Thrones
The Game of Thrones is a great example where I think that that the common complaint with this final season is that and we really came to know these characters and things are moving too fast, that there's too much entropy and that the decisions the characters are making are not necessarily jiving with what we've known about them over the first seven seasons.
Right. And I think you can do both. You can do both. And this is not necessarily a Game of Thrones critique. This is more like a on the concept of can you have lots of fluidity and have consistent character motivations? I think you can do both. It's hard to do. But so all the chaos has to come from a central core character trait or some core character motivation. And you have to be able to track that through all of these moves, or at the very least, when they do these moves, you know, like you can like identify or root for that character while they're doing them. Like I would imagine like a Littlefinger like character, you're some Master of Whispers kind of thing where like maybe they're duping everyone in a different way. And you're like, oh man, that guy's he's so badass. He's duping all these people. Mm-hmm. Emily and I were doing a little bit of rewatching of old seasons of Game of Thrones, like in the early seasons when you have like, you know, when you have someone like a Tyrion who's just outmaneuvering everyone in King's Landing, and you're like, yeah, I love it. Like you love those moments. So as long as you maintain that, you still understand that someone like a Tyrion character is like, you love him because of his character traits. Oh, he's very clever. That's important. I'm not an expert in TV characters or anything, but I know that there are people who apply this sort of test of a character, and it's a good test of whether or not they're memorable to you. Can you describe them without saying what they look like what their job is or what specific things they've done? I've seen this in a few contexts, of explaining characters. I think it's a very good test.
Well, I think that it's something that when people want to be cast on the show, I think that this is, an exercise that I would tell people to do something very similar before they make their tape, in terms of, you know, people get very focused on, why they want to be on the show or why they think they can win. And I think that they need to be able to describe themselves in the terms that you're talking about, to be able to have some sort of a casting person be able to then talk about them without using necessarily what their job title might be or what they look like.
Right, exactly. And then you can tell, and that's why a lot of times people will gravitate towards like these returning players. Like, I know this whole segment's about like me talking about Aubrey. Like you can talk about Aubrey in terms of her character traits. You know, it's like, oh, she's smart. She's very witty, you know, talks about Oregon Trail, you know, this sort of thing. Like, these core character traits and coleslaw. But like, you remember things that Aubrey did. You remember her character traits. And just to make sure I sort of tie it back to, like, you know, this subject a bit. But yeah, so you have all these. So this was all about, I was talking about what experiences Aubrey had in her past seasons and how limited any one of us survivors are to the actual survivor experience. Like, have you actually had to survive a blindside that was coming your way? Did you have to sniff it out? Or did you, like, not sniff it out, but you survived to tell the tale, or didn't, and they're coming back for a second time? And if you don't know those feelings, it's hard to know if you would be it's hard to know in the future when you're experiencing those things again. Actually, when I thought of Aubrey getting blindsided at that vote, I thought a lot of your All-Stars experience, Rob. And let me know if this is a fair comparison. When I listened to your Evolutionary Strategy Chapter 8, you kind of documented what that experience was like leading up to that tribal council, how it kind of felt. And I remember you saying that this was your first tribal council with this entire group, and things felt a little different. But maybe this is just how people do things, and you could probably this is my recollection how you described it,
right?
And so it didn't raise too many alarm bells as a result. I mean, Aubrey had this exact same thing. You know, she's playing not only with a new group for the first time, she's also playing with a bunch of first time players, and this is her first tribal council she's going to with them. So she has no idea what normal is like. So she doesn't know. So, and add on top of that, if she doesn't have a good barometer of what it feels like to be blindsided. And again, Aubrey, if you're listening, if you do, I'm trying to short shrift you. I'm looking back into the past, and I'm like not seeing that that she was never at a point where people were looking to gun for her. She found ways to not be the person being gunned for. But because she doesn't have that baseline, then she could easily get blindsided. That's completely understandable for me. It's a little bit more surprising for someone like a Kelly Wentworth, who did have to go through his experience. And I remember that was one of the more interesting scenes that stuck out for me in watching this season, was when I forget what episode it was, but Kelly Wentworth felt that things were going sideways against her and she might want to play her idol, ultimately didn't need to play it. But she was like, this feels like Cambodia all over again.
Mm-hmm. I think it might have been the merge. I think it might have been
the merge.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So the merge. Yeah. So it's like, that's interesting. That's the feeling. And she knows that feeling. And what is that in reality? I mean, feelings are a bit nebulous to talk about. But what is actually happening is probably provoking these feelings. Well, you might notice people aren't as happy to talk to you or looking to talk to you, kind of like the whole Zeke metric we talked about earlier. You might notice that people are just a little bit different around you. I mean, Yao Man, when he was about to be blindsided in season 14, you know, talked about he's getting bad vibes or whatever. I mean, that's what people describe. Right. It's aggregation of data. So if you've experienced that, you have a barometer for it. So it's a little bit more surprising for me when Kelly Wentworth gets blindsided.
Well, let me just ask in terms of you, Do you feel like now, as somebody who has gone through that experience, that do you feel like that you could be blindsided again? Because I will tell you that I feel like now that I know what it feels like, I almost feel like I feel like I would be able to sniff it out if I played again.
I think I have a much better barometer than I would have obviously before I started playing the show, for sure. I mean, saying can't, that's tough, because let's investigate, like, what happened with Kelly Wentworth. She got voted out, and again, it happens. I get it. Blind sides are a thing, but like War Dog had this very interesting scene where he talked about how did he do the blind side. He just went, had quick conversation with everyone, right? This, like, this whatever 30-second conversation thing. So maybe there was a new mechanism there that she hadn't quite experienced, this very sort of subtle approach to blindsiding her. Whereas in Cambodia, I believe Joe of all people tipped her off, if I remember my Cambodia history correctly. So she was tipped off in that. But yeah, there's probably still evidence of what it's like to be nearing a blindside. Like, I definitely compiled a bunch of evidence as to what that's like. Just from my experience, I can list off what it was like when I was the target at the merge, when Angelina decided with militaristic language that I needed to be taken out, yes, you know, via with a surprise attack. And I had the benefit of knowing that was the case. And this is kind of a beautiful period of time I never got to talk about too much, is that I had this beautiful window where I knew everybody was lying to me, but they didn't know that I knew. So I just went and talked to everybody. It's like, what's it like to be lied to your face? And I think I might have mentioned to you that the people are pretty good liars. And it was interesting. I noticed people were a little shorter with wanting to talk to me. There actually were. I'm not a believer in, like, tells in poker. I mean, granted, I don't play poker, so I could be totally wrong. But, like, I'm not convinced in my life that I can, like, oh, here's this person's tell when they're lying. At least that's as a reliable thing. It might be a thing. Mm-hmm. But I did notice a few people, like, did some things when they were lying.
Right.
Things like, it's almost stereotypical, like, things like for lying. And I was surprised. I expected it to be more subtle.
Right. Like, wanted to wrap up the conversation. They didn't really want to, you know, engage with you on the contingencies or anything like that.
Right. Yeah. The contingency, particularly that's another trick, is that the fake plan is less deep than the real plan. Typically, that's a heuristic I like to go by. Mm-hmm. That if they're not, that if they don't, it's, they don't want to go into the fake plans as much, it's because they haven't had, it's not as deep as the real plan.
Right. And it's been such a calling card of this season that the person who gets blindsided is the person who feels like, all right, well, this is the simple vote. This is the simple vote. And sometimes the simple vote is the way to go. And we have not seen the simple vote carried out.
That's true. I mean, in a way, that's really admirable of these players, that they're at least, they have the capacity to be very active and not just letting the game go. I'm sure that might some people might say that's bad gameplay, and that's very situation dependent. But no, I like the fact that people are assessing whether or not this current way things are moving is good for them. Also, it's probably a little bit of an artifact of that. It's not always the best plan that is, or at least the most well hashed out plan that takes effect. It's the last plan. I know Stephen Fishback has talked about this in the past, that, like, oh, it's the most recent plan. That's the new plan. once it's pitched, you're like, okay, let's go with that. And then, it's the last plan for tribal. So that's the one. So when it gets really creative, it almost becomes a roulette wheel as to which plan can come into effect. Especially it was much more of a roulette wheel if the weather comes in and then it storms and you have to go back in the shelter. Or, you know, adds another variable to it too. So, but yeah, you're right. It has been a calling card of the season that there's almost none of these votes have been very simple. I mean, that merge vote was kind of like an elaborate 3-2-1-esque vote where they basically told people to vote different ways, and they got six people to vote for, to vote out in a group of, what was it, 13 at the merge? Yeah, I think that's right. But they got a majority out of six people when they shouldn't have, right? So, which, in effect, it was like a split vote plan where they didn't tell the split votes exactly what the real plan was. So, that, in effect, that's the way I see it. But it's also all pretty complicated, and you can tell that some of these people are having so much fun with these plans. Like, you can tell Ron was just tickled pink with it, with some of his votes that he was doing. And War Dog, too. I mean, they just have a, they have a flair for, they really wanted to come out and play what they perceive to be a very complex and strategic game. And, you know, good for them. I mean, and I will say, sort of, especially for someone like a Ron Clark, when I heard he was going to be on the show, you have this guy who is an educator, you know, mm-hmm. a famous educator, you know, there's all this, you know, this good education work started this academy in Atlanta. And I would be worried that someone like him would shy away from these kinds of moves because he, out of fear that somehow it would impact the reputation of his program or something like that because he's being seen running around scheming on Survivor. But no, it's just the opposite. He's embracing the whole sort of strategic schemey component of the game. So that's in a lot of ways that's pretty brave. And I appreciate that. War Dog, it seems, and this is nothing against him, it seems more on type, that there's almost like almost a Tony-esque brand, to certain kinds of players. And he's living up to that, at least while he was in the game proper so far.
Okay. Let me bring in another question. And this is from one of our listeners. This is actually a voicemail. And this is from Wave, who wants to ask you about Aurora's perspective on this final six vote last night.
Hey there, Rob. This is Wave from Florida. First time caller, but I've been loving RHIP ever since I first heard about it during the Philippines. So this episode focused a lot on Rick Devins and on what's best strategically for the trio of Gavin, Victoria, and Lauren. But I'm wondering about Aurora. Aside from being better at word scrambles, what could Aurora have done to save herself? Should she have talked to Devins and Julie? Should she have thrown one of her own alliance members under the bus to the other two? Maybe she should have put more effort into increasing the target on Julie? If you guys were in Aurora's shoes, what would you have done to avoid the vote this week? Can't wait to hear what you guys think. Thanks so much.
Okay, now here's Aurora, who ends up being voted out at the final six. And I think that she was probably the victim of, hey, let's just go with the simple vote tonight. Let's vote out Julie. She is not immune. Rick's not going to play the idol on her. We don't even know if Rick's idol is real. Let's just stick to the plan and vote out Julie.
Yeah, so Aurora, that's sort of an interesting happenstance that she got sent home. I thought that she was locked into the finals for a while. I thought that that there was enough of perception based on what we saw that she was that she wasn't like the mover and shaker. She wasn't a pilot, let's say, or compared to some of the other players, and maybe more of a passenger in their eyes. I don't know if that's actually true, but that was my perception. So I figured like, oh. I figured just people were trying to pocket in Aurora to take her to the end. Also, in taking out Aurora, I'm just in talking about like the reasoning behind getting rid of her, like I would have assumed that they would be looking to keep in more people who were challenge threats.
Yes.
To stop Rick Devins. That was my thinking.
And I said the same thing with Steven last night on the Know It Alls, that I thought that was a mistake to get rid of Aurora if you're trying to stop Rick Devins.
Yeah, and a lot – I know a lot of the factors go into these decisions, a lot of which is convenience. Like, yeah, you know, like, oh, it would be great if we got rid of it would be great if we kept Aurora around, but who can we get rid of instead? I mean, and there was the Julie option there for them instead. I confess, I don't fully understand all the motivations behind this vote. Do you have, like, an insight into, like, why it was – Julie, why it was not Julie? Was it because of the Rick Devins?
So, like, I think at the core of all of this was the relationship between Julie and Lauren. And this was something that I was talking about on the Know-It-Alls last night, where I thought that for Gavin and Victoria, I thought this was a missed opportunity to not vote out Lauren at this vote and potentially set some sort of a 3-2-1 plan in motion. But I think that really, in the light of day, that would hinge on whether or not Lauren was saying, I will not vote for Julie under any circumstances. Did Lauren really force the hand? It seemed like that she went to Gavin and said, hey, why don't I vote, or why don't we vote with Rick and with Julie on this vote to take out Aurora. And it made it seem like that Gavin was like, well, let's see what Victoria says about this, where I don't feel like that Lauren was giving an ultimatum. And I don't know if Lauren would go to a 3-3 tie if Gavin says, under no way, no how are we voting Aurora out at this tribal council.
Yeah, the Rock's game of chicken. Yeah, so that is an interesting bold play by Lauren. I'm kind of surprised that that worked in that sort of scenario because, at that final six, if I were in that position, and this is just me, and I don't know all their circumstances, but like I would try to make sure that I'm working with as many people as I can and not really put my thumb in the eye of saying of any target and say I will not vote for them under any circumstances. Is that what she said? I try to remember the exact circumstances of that conversation of them talking, but like Lauren is. She's an interesting player this season. I'm sorry, I'm a little all over the place. I'm thinking about all the things she did this episode, including the approaching Devins about the idol. We'll get to that at some point. I'll make sure to put a pin in that.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of – that's why Julie was safe. She put her foot down. I don't think Lauren would go to rocks either. Especially for someone who's going to be throwing – would she throw in her lot to go to rocks on the same side as Rick – Devins. I mean, I guess the thing is their side of the vote has, and if they went to rocks, they have Rick Devins who's immune.
Yeah.
So that's one less rock they have to draw.
Right.
So they'd have the relative advantage of the rock draw. So there's that. Being on the side with the immunity gives you a relative advantage.
And then also, if then Julie was going to be the person that had the three votes on her, then also she would be immune on the revote. Right.
Yeah.
Aurora would be immune. And so that if it did go to some potential rock draw, if it got far enough, then... It would be
2-3. It would be 2-1.
Gavin, Victoria, and who would be the third person?
It would be Lauren. Lauren would be drawing a rock.
Okay, so Lauren would be drawing a rock in that scenario. Now, if she had the presence of mind to also play her idol at that tribal council, then she could get Gavin or Victoria out of the game, which I don't know if that's necessarily top of mind for her.
By the way, can we also talk about how easy it is to forget that she has an idol this season?
Am I the only one?
It is kind of funny. Like, you know, they of course started including the thing at on the lower third, saying one immunity idol, mm-hmm. to indicate that they have an immunity idol. Which, in some ways, I'm glad they did. In a way, for the people who like to complain that the show is more about. It's more about idols and advantages than characters. They have now literally replaced in the lower third your profession with how many idols you have. So there's to people who are of that position, they have the literal example to point to. If she had the presence of mind to play her idol, then yeah, she can directly force the hand of Victoria and Gavin.
Let's listen back to this part of the episode and see if we get some insight. Okay, here is Lauren just coming out of her conversation with Julie, and now she's going to talk to Gavin.
Next to her at the end. And I think that I have a better chance of beating her than I do Aurora. I think that Julie has become a very emotional player, and so I don't think a lot of the jury likes Julie.
I do not plan on putting my votes on you.
Okay.
I'm still talking to Julie.
Gavin.
Okay.
So I'm going to have to try to convince Gavin that his best play is to not take Aurora to the end.
This is the kind of thing where it's like, we let Julie go. It just looks stupid to me. I say we plan on voting Aurora. I mean, you're number one, so if you don't want to do that, then that's fine.
I mean, I'd rather have Vic in on it just so she's not likely to flip on us the next vote.
Yeah, but if she's chest it down hard, do you still want to do it?
We'll get it figured out. Let me talk to her first, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like that's an ultimatum to me.
No, it doesn't to me either.
And it seems like that her perspective is like, hey, well, Julie is really easy to beat at the end as opposed to Aurora, who's going to be harder to beat. But how many people are in the final three?
Yeah, I mean, it's it, if I had to guess what the thought process is in that moment for someone like Gavin, he's probably feels like, dang, I'm in a pickle. I'm in a pickle right now. Nick, the easy vote would have been Devin's. It's going to be one of these other ones. He might be a little scared at this point. And he's just like, who do we get rid of? And someone, and in this case, you had, Lauren, that is Lauren approaching him, right? So he has Lauren approaching him, saying that, is Lauren approaching him saying, hey, here's a target and here's a reason that's arguable. And he'd be like, oh, okay, well, I'm going to get Vic on board because, you know, she's, you know, I need her in on because I don't want to be, basically he's trying to be on the right side is what I hear there.
It's arguably a little
passive, but that's, you know, based upon my read of just, you know, me watching it last night and just, you know, I'm glad you played that again. In that context, yeah, it does not sound like an ultimatum.
Yeah, she's not really coming to him with a hard sell, and it does work. I think from Gavin's perspective, it's like, hey, if I could get to the final four here with myself, Lauren, Julie, and Victoria, it's a guaranteed win for me, Gavin.
Do we have a scene or any kind of indication of how Gavin feels about his final three chances? Or is that you thinking out loud because
I think that he feels like the only people that can beat him in immunities at this point in time are Devin's and Aurora. And so I think he feels like, well, I'm probably guaranteed to win the final four immunity if that's the group. So if we vote out Aurora, then we vote out Devin's, and then we vote out the returning player from Extinction in some order.
Got it.
And then
always say win.
Yeah.
So when you said win, you mean like immunity, not like win at the.
Well, I think Gavin probably thinks that he is the player to beat between out of that four.
That's interesting. I guess this could be the situation that everyone being the hero of their own narrative.
Right.
Because I mean, that's actually something that's important to sort of remember if you're a player out there. I mean, if you are out there thinking that, hey, I have the best chance to win, one, you could be wrong for one, but also everyone else probably, just because we are human beings with egos, might have an opinion of ourselves that is greater than, in fact, on average, we do, mm-hmm. Psychologically speaking, have higher opinion of ourselves than if it tested against reality on average. So that's interesting. So that creates a dynamic. Let's assume then that you have, of these six remaining players, approximately half, if not more, who think that they have a great shot at the end if they get to the end, as long as Rick's not there. Mm-hmm. Let's go with that model of what's happening in the game right now. So that would mean that most people, are going to be fine with whatever plan comes their way, as long as it gets them a little further. And that leaves open a window for someone like a Lauren to shape the vote in the way that she would prefer it to go. In this case, she wants Julie to stick around and wants Aurora gone. Do we have any insight as to whether Lauren actually thinks Aurora is a bigger threat, or is that this is?
In her confessional too. She's talking. I mean. That she's talking about it, I think, in her confessional, but she's also saying it to Julie, and then she's trying to keep Julie in the game. So think that we can. That's something that I think that probably is a known for us. That
no. Thank you.
Lauren feels like that she can beat Julie in the final three, and there's some concern about whether or not they could beat Aurora. Aurora might feel like has a better story.
Yeah, and just to back up a little, the meta watching of the show here, I'm sure a lot of your learned podcast audience is kind of used to this lingo already. But in case they aren't, you know, it is true as that I'm a lot more suspicious of what someone says not in confessional than in confessional. That confessional is almost the gold standard of getting what someone actually thinks. You can kind of detect sometimes when it's edited in a way where the language is a bit choppy and they create what's called a Frankenbite. Mm-hmm. And like, it was interesting watching the show that I was on and seeing, okay, what was a true unedited line and what was kind of cobbled together to tell the story in a cleaner way than I did in the real time. For instance, when I was being targeted by Gabby, there's a line on the show where it's like, and I don't believe it. that when Davey told me that I was being targeted by Gabby. It's like, I never once said that, but it was a cleaner way to tell a story where I wasn't sure. Whereas I really trusted Davey that he was telling me the truth. So, it was a cleaner way to tell the story. So, it sounds, so in fishing out what the true motivations are here, it sounds like, that the narrative on the beach in the mind of Lauren is that Aurora actually is kind of a jury threat and Julie is not.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, presented to the audience, the portrayal of Julie is pretty sympathetic, as far as I can tell, but also relative to sympathetic, certainly relative to what I sometimes see in the game. Like when we saw that crazy tribal council, with where Julia went home and Julie, what she stood up and said, it's like, I'm not going to take it anymore. You know, she has her network moment or whatever, that thing.
I'm jumping ship.
I'm jumping ship. That's it. Thank you. That's the line. And, that is the sort of thing that, like, if that happened in my season, I'd be like, I've been flabbergasted and not necessarily in a good way. I'd be like, I can't believe someone is like just broadcasting their intentions like that. So I don't know. But I don't know. It's hard to read who is a real jury threat relative to everybody. It's very difficult to tell. But we're kind of left with the narrative that we get from, in this case, Lauren. So Rob, what are the known knowns here in terms of jury threats this season?
Okay.
We know Rick Devins.
Rick Devins certainly appears to be a jury threat.
Yes.
Kelly Wentworth seems like she really likes Gavin, but she also really likes Lauren. So I really think that the best bet for Gavin would to be in a final three where Lauren is not there with him, where then he could pick up the Kelly Wentworth contingent of people who are sort of like sympathetic to Gavin, people that just overall like them, nice young kids, got a great story about how he pushed his wedding date up and has, you know, he's starting a new life with his wife and he's won immunities. He's been willing to make big moves. He was part of the flip against people like Eric. He was able to get back on the right side of the numbers after that all fell apart with the pilots versus passengers, Rick Devins tribal council.
Yeah.
So I think that Gavin has a decent story and a claim there with the jury. I think that people don't necessarily look at him as malicious in the jury, even for the people that he flipped against.
Yeah, he certainly seems like a likable guy that people seem to like him when they had the little loved ones visit. Then everyone's polite during the loved ones visit, but people seem to genuinely support him when his wife came out.
Yeah.
For that. So that's believable. It's hard for me to assess someone like a Victoria's standing.
We've heard almost nothing about Victoria from the other players, where the viewers have reacted very positively to Victoria, but you have not heard much this season another player talk about what they think about Victoria in terms of being a threat in this game, where we've heard only about it like is Victoria with us or not.
That's kind of surprising. I mean, I think this could be, of course, a consequence of limited airtime. We have 16 people left in the game, and you got to distribute the airtime in a certain way. But yeah, it's kind of surprising because I would imagine someone who might have a positive opinion of Victoria might be like an Aubrey. I don't know. That's my guess, because if you believe the whole black cat analogy, that she believed her that she was going to be that Victoria was going to be Aubrey's apprentice, got blindsided by her. I don't know if what Aubrey's attitude would be toward that, other than like a game respects game. Certainly when she went out the door, she complimented everybody. Then again, I think 3-4 weeks on Edge of Extinction can change anyone's opinion on, it's almost like being, you can be gaslighted pretty easily out there. I can only imagine.
That's right.
Yeah.
So that's an unknown. And in terms of Aurora, I think that she has a good story. I don't know if she's well-liked.
Aurora at that Pilots of Passengers Tribal Council was kind of pinned as the person who put their foot in their mouth. And The closest analogy that I can think of to what I experienced was like when Angelina was trying to curry jury votes at the merge. It's probably not to that extreme where like her own alliance called out Angelina at that tribal council. So it's not that extreme, but everyone talked about, oh, Aurora, she done screwed up. That's the kind of thing that people remember. And there are a lot of reasons that someone can vote for a finalist at final tribal council. But I think generally you want to at least have a good idea that this person tried to play the game in a way that you felt was sort of competent. And even if Aurora like plays like overall like a competent game, people will remember that one big foot in the mouth moment. Right. And so it's sort of a thing where people might say, Aurora's not thinking on the same, you know, the strategic level that I am on the jury. And they might judge her for that. So, yeah, I don't know where this idea of the of Aurora being the jury threat to get rid of comes from. Then again, I'm sitting on a couch. So watching the very edited version, but I will say you can really, I mentioned gaslighting, you know, that you can gaslight people on the island. I feel like that's something, and I'm thinking, yeah, exactly. I mean, you are so isolated from any sort of external source of reality or sort of external error checking. And yeah, Eric Reichenbach's a perfect example. He got convinced that somehow it was a good example, a good idea to give up his immunity necklace. And I try to empathize with him on that point. I don't think I think that when people call Eric Reichenbach stupid for that, they are missing the point. They are missing the point of what it's like to be out there. I'll give you an example with Mike White from my season.
Please.
He was pretty good at this. Like, people were threats on the island, often because Mike White said they were threats. And because the notion of a threat is such a nebulous notion, you can cast anyone as a threat. I mean, it becomes almost comically meta, and where you people say, oh, this person's a threat because no one sees them as a threat right now. Well, geez, I mean, what does that mean? It means nothing. And it means nothing. And you can exploit that ambiguity on the island. Really effectively. So I'd say one thing, that if I were to go back and tell, you know, past me on the island, it would be to shape the narrative more like Mike does. And maybe this is a really good example of Lauren going into this conversation, and maybe she believes it, and it's almost irrelevant whether or not Lauren believes that Aurora is a bigger jury threat. She can just say it. And if it becomes the narrative on the island, it might as well be true. So that is a really interesting way to sort of approach the game, which is like narrative shaping. The theme of the season is a good, way to abuse that. So the whole David versus Goliath narrative became a powerful weapon to shape the narrative. So like when Mike White is talking about, you know, Christian is the David of the Davids, you know, it's basically written for, you know, one of the Davids to slay a Goliath. And he pins this sort of narrative mantle on me. Well, guess what? I'm marked. And you can use that. I mean, so and so if you can creatively use that to your advantage, such as the Edge of Extinction, that's really smart. So this is all in response to the Aurora question. So just to put a capper on that. So that way, his name is Wave or Wade?
Wave.
Cool name, Wave. And also, also I should say, you know, hello, fellow Floridian. I'm now living in Tallahassee.
Oh.
That's what I do now. I'm a professor at Florida State University. So fellow Floridian, yeah. So, Wave, what could Aurora have done?
Yeah,
I like to answer this. So, if I'm Aurora, I was actually kind of shocked that she was on the Rick Devens is a thorn in my side train. To me, Aurora, I felt would benefit pretty effectively from someone like a Rick Devens being in the game. So, because like if I'm Aurora and I put myself in Rick Devens' shoes, I think, I'm Rick Devens. No one wants to play with me. I'm desperate for anyone to play with me. Now, Julie picked up this, you know, picked up this football from this fumble, and said, go to, and went up to Rick and said, hey, I'll work with you. And because I feel like I'm on the bottom. Aurora could have done this too. And maybe under the thought that, hey, who, because Rick has to believe that if he gets to the end, he's winning. I think he thinks that. So in his mind, anyone would be stupid to take him to the end. So who would make the decision to take me to the end? Maybe someone who made a rash decision at tribal council. Mm-hmm. And so if I'm Aurora and it's like, and I admittedly put my foot in my mouth at that very interesting, crazy tribal council, I can use that to my advantage and say, people know that I'm a little bit of a wild card. Maybe I'm wild, and maybe Rick thinks I'm wild enough to actually work with him instead of just shining him on. So in that case, you go to Rick, and maybe Rick actually believes you might want to work with him, and you come up with some reason. Maybe it's like, oh, you know, I'm hearing Vic, and I'm hearing Gavin. They're talking about getting rid of me now. It doesn't even have to be true. She doesn't even know if it's true or not. She's like, I see people are trying to get rid of me now, and this is crazy. I have no idea why they do this. Look, I'm jumping ship. I'm jumping ship. Aurora, jumping ship. I need to find a way to get rid of them.
She did get left behind at the reward, which I think is a important piece of information that should have been in her brain. And she talked about it in the episode.
She did. She did. So that's the perfect justification for her to go to Rick. At least on the surface there. There's a theme here, which is plausible narratives. When plausible narrative can you weave to any particular person to convince them that you are realistically going to work with them? If you don't have a plausible narrative, then it seems like, why do you want to work with me? But she was handed a gift. Thank you for reminding me, Rob, that she was left behind.
Now, are you saying that she should go to Rick Devins and try to get Rick Devins on board with her plan, hypothetically, let's blindside Gavin tonight, and then she would stay on board with the plan to go after Julie at the tribal council? Is that what you're saying she should do?
I think that that's a better idea than assuming that after you're left behind in the reward that you're not going to be one of the sacrificial lambs because Rick Devins won another immunity. Mm-hmm. I think that that would be definitely a plausible way to move forward. Plus, who would that separate? Would that separate Victoria and any connection of Victoria and Lauren? Because it looks like Lauren approached Gavin, and Gavin brings along Victoria. Mm-hmm. So at which point, this makes Gavin an interesting power center, I think about it in that structure.
Well, Lauren said, you're my number one to Gavin.
This is, again, I'm sorry. I have a hard time tracking this sometimes. First off, a smart thing to say. Mm-hmm. It's hard to keep track of. So, but if that's the case, then she did a good job of bringing him along. And so here's a good heuristic.
And I think that they were remnants of that. I think that Kelly had cultivated that group. And I think that the show made it seem like Lesu 3. I think War Dog was more on the outs with that group.
Right.
And Gavin and Lauren were the people that I think that Kelly probably wanted to go to the end with.
Oh, that makes so much sense. Yeah, because the narratives, here are the narratives that I tracked, like going for, like from the merge onward. There was the Lesu 3, right? Then there was the comma six after, it was the comma six after it became, so it was the comma, because it was, what was the balance?
The comma six was not with Joe.
Was not with Joe. They got rid of Joe, and also Aurora was on the outside.
Aurora, I don't think, was part of the comma six either.
She was not. So my answer to what Aurora should have done is I think she should have leveraged her position as person who can be a bit of a loose cannon, not always in on things. She's like, you know what? I'm tired of being left out on rewards. I'm tired of being left out on these votes. Rick, I know you've been left out on some of these votes too. It's time to change that. I'm fed up with this. That's a plausible narrative you can send to him. And what do you do with that? I like that idea of taking out Gavin. My specific distillation of that idea is that when there's a power center that does not benefit you, you just take out the center of that power. That's a good heuristic. When I say heuristic, I mean rule of thumb. That's something that's a good rule of thumb. If you're not pleased with how things are going right now, the question is, who do you take out? A good person is the person at the center of the power or connecting a lot of people. This was the justification for getting rid of, in my season, getting rid of Jessica Pete in our first vote of the season, actually. Yes. Yeah. And not because Jessica Pete was necessarily calling all the shots, but Jessica Pete was close to B, and Carl was close to her. She also wrapped in Pat pretty effectively. And so, and also I think that, she had some fair ties to Gabby, but also she was pretty close to Davey, more so than other people were. So it's like, oh, well, she's kind of connecting everyone. And this was literally Elizabeth's justification, which I happened to agree with at the time, which was that she's the glue. You get rid of her. You split up everybody. It's broken up into a million pieces, and we're the new power center. And it was true. That's exactly what happened. So that would be my Aurora move, would be to leverage Rick Devon's desperation for an alliance to get rid of the current power structure center, which would be Gavin.
Let me make a different proposal, okay. Which is probably might be bolder. And you tell me if this could have worked in her favor. At the tribal council, she seemed to be the most skeptical about Rick Devon's playing the idol for Julie. Could she have really had more showmanship? Is it showwomanship?
Oh, I don't know.
I've never heard that word, but I want to get it right.
Yeah, I'm not an expert on that, but I'll defer.
Could she be more showy and say, Rick Devon's, you are not going to play this idol for Julie tonight. One, I don't even know if it's a real idol. And if it is, a la not Rick Devin's, but a Devin Pinto, go play it for her right now. Go play that idol for Julie right now and show us that you're serious. And if you are, I'll vote with you tonight.
That would certainly change the narrative table. So this is obviously a different universe than the one we just talked about, where she somehow aligns with Rick Devon's, right? So this is like everything plays out roughly as it had up until Tribal Council, and the threat is made to play it to play the idol on Julie,
right?
So what does that at a minimum, that shows gusto on Aurora's part. It actually probably would. If I were on the jury, I would be like,
yeah, it'd be like, that's whoa, smart. Oh, who's that's this? Really, oh, somebody besides Rick Devon's is making a fuss at this tribal council. Okay, yeah. Let me sit up a little straighter in my seat and watch what's going on. And if Aurora says, hey, I might be sleeping on the edge of extinction tonight, but I'll tell you what, you're not leaving this tribal council with a idol in your pocket and the necklace around your neck. So
and Julie. I mean, you should keep both of them. So, and Julie, you don't get all three.
Yeah, pick two.
Okay. It's the triangle of like Devon's. You get your necklace, your idol, or jewelry. You get to pick two.
And he left with all three.
He did. Oh, God. I mean, this is a sort of thing that it's he's getting away with murder in a way at the tribal council. That certainly would, one, is bold.
Yes.
And two, at the very least, it shapes the narrative in a more positive way for her. Because we haven't talked about what is a, too much about what is a like a good move for Rick or a bad move for Rick at these sorts of things. But one thing is for sure is that he's seen as a huge jury threat. And so one way
and the reason why he's seen as a huge jury threat is because he does exactly the type of things that we're talking about right now.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and additionally, I'm curious about, I challenge that slightly because I would push back. I'm curious in the alternate universe where he is not grandstanding as much a tribal council, but is, but somehow making it through being targeted. He probably could come through at the end and say, hey, look, I got voted about it. I had to come back. I was targeted multiple times all the way down to the end, and I'm still around, regardless of grandstanding. The grandstanding on top is just like, it's just a cherry on top of all this. Mm-hmm. You're like, oh my God, so showy. But so what you can do is, if you're an Aurora or somebody, geez, anybody who isn't a Rick Devon's, okay? If you want to start hedging your bets against him eventually getting to the final three, I feel like one of the only big cases you can make is you could say, hey, Rick was left out a lot of these votes. So yeah, he was immune. Yeah, he survived a lot of these votes, but the plans were happening all around him. Look who took control of the game. We were in control all along, as you saw at this hypothetical tribal council we're talking about, where Aurora stands up and said, no, we, you know, the game, this game is mine and it's not yours, Rick. And it didn't have to be Aurora. I mean, it's, I'm curious.
But Aurora should have been the person that could have put the pieces together of, boy, I was the person that got left out of going on the reward with Gavin. Yes. If they did, if this group of four did turn on somebody, I'm low person on the totem pole.
I think that you're right in that she is the most, she's the most plausible vessel for it in terms of the circumstance. She has the most plausible narrative that she can spin based on that. And she has, I feel like she has the most to gain. She's a lot to gain from that. She, I feel like it, when you have in your own confessional, you talk about how you screwed up at tribal council and put the foot in your mouth. And you have people who seem to be mad at her. I'm trying to remember, I rewatched the merge onward. And people were openly mad with her after that after the pilots and passengers tribal council. Mm-hmm. I have a feeling she felt like she was on the outs.
Yeah.
So she knows she has to make up for something in all likelihood. So you're right. She is the one that could benefit from that. This is sort of an interesting like gamesmanship, which is the showiness at tribal council. It's something that didn't really crop up too much on my season because everything going into tribal council was kind of a blind side for everybody. There wasn't always infrequently was there a consensus target like Rick Devens who was immune, right? We didn't like there like that was pretty uncommon. So there was no one with with nothing to lose except for like Elizabeth. I think Elizabeth was the only one. So she went and did that sort of whispering in the ears sort of situation. But there's a lot of grandstanding. So in a game where you have a ton of grandstanding or someone who's grandstanding, do you have to out grandstand the grandstander?
I think so, because I think that this is something that has happened with the evolution of the game here. And I think that immunity idols ties into this because that is grandstanding. And, you know, we saw it with, you know, the different idols and advantages that got played in your season. And the person that won your season was somebody who was famous for moves that were made at the tribal council and people taking credit for moves and idols that were played at these tribal councils, that the people that decide the game are sitting there at tribal council and they are not on the beach. They're not seeing the social things that happen or in terms of the competition wins don't mean that much. What means the most? The stuff that happens in front of the jury. So if that is what your strong suit is, I think that you have a big advantage in this game.
That's interesting. I would push back a touch on that, because you also, I mean, yeah, you have tribal council, which is the only thing the jury sees. There's a lot of chatter about what's going on in the game back at the jury house, or in this case, Edge of Extinction. So like I'm trying to put myself back in when I was sitting on the jury. Mm-hmm. How much was I paying attention to the theater of tribal council? It was a little hard to gauge because there was such a at tribal councils, there's such a layer of bullshit to everything being said.
Right.
And so like, and that was a lot on our season. I'm sure it's the same with these guys too, but to the point where like when people are talking, for the most part, I hear wah, 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 wah at tribal council. When I'm like on the jury, I'm like, I'm paying attention to literally what everyone's saying, but it's very rare where something crops up that's actually indicative of the plan going down. It's all signaling toward the, which way that the, that you want everyone else to think the plan is going down. Now, the only time that really breaks down are at these crazy tribal councils we're talking about, the pilots and passengers, right? Where it has to be literal because there needs to be a real plan that comes into place at tribal council, or when you have Rick Devens doing a big show-stopping maneuver like this, which is designed to change votes. And I think, and I'm trying to remember my own season correctly, but the only thing that, was designed to change votes at tribal council, in the post-merge game that I was in was when Elizabeth went around whispering to people in their ears. Here's in season 38, there's a lot more of that. So now it's a grandstanding game. So I just want to point out that difference. So if you're on the jury and you're seeing actual literal plans being discussed in front of everybody, I think you're right. I think you have to out-grandstand the grandstander, or at least participate in that grandstanding game, or at the very least find ways to deflate the grandstanding going on. I mean, basically, we're seeing
how much egg would Rick Devens have on his face where that he said he was going to do this, said he was going to do this. They call him out and then Julie gets voted out and he didn't play the idol on her.
Yeah, you got to deflate him somehow. I mean, like, yeah, exactly. I mean, so here's the dilemma I'm sure other people have thought of. But like, so how do you treat Rick Devens in this case? For one, let me agree with you. Yes, he would have egg on his face and it would deflate him in front of the jury. So that would be a really smart way to deflate him.
Or maybe, just as good. Aurora does this whole thing, somehow gets Rick Devens to play the idol on Julie. Everybody still votes out Aurora, and at least Rick Devens doesn't have the idol in the next round.
she took away his idol to the bullet form. I guess it's sort of like a sacrificial sort of thing. But yeah, or at the very least, yeah, he gets him to play the idol. Maybe she's not the target. For all she knows, she doesn't know she's the target at this tribal council. Mm-hmm. So we have to put herself in that position. Even though I agree with you, there were signals.
She's at the edge of extinction anyway with a better highlight reel.
Exactly. Let's go to in the finale. Let's go to Aurora's highlight reel. Yeah. This is where she called out Rick Devens.
Yeah, maybe she's playing an all-star season after that. But she's still on the edge of extinction.
Yeah, that's right. And that's a different game entirely, right? Like, you could imagine that there are people that would be like, yeah, you know, I'm screwed, but I might as well have this cool moment. You know, maybe get brought back for another season, or at least I get to feel satisfied. I think a lot of it's for some people, they want to get their satisfaction. Mm-hmm. In the moment. I mean, like with Rick at the previous tribal council where he got Ron out of the game with the Ben bomb. I mean, you wonder what was going through his head. You're like, oh man, this is my opportunity. I can say whatever I want, well, because at that point I control the votes.
Rick even touched on this where he said, hey, I was playing this game. I was a nice guy and I got voted out. So I came back into the game and I decided to, you know, play hard and play for me and say what was on my mind. And he's been a different guy since he's come back.
Yeah, some people can find that refreshing, you know, if you've come across less filtered, and that's always I think that actually is one of the things that can really kill you in a final tribal council is insincerity.
Mm-hmm.
If you come across as an insincere person at that
time, do you feel like that's almost been insincere since he's come back?
No. I'm saying I don't think at any point does Rick Devens come across as insincere.
He's dropped the pretense.
I think both things can be sincere. I think that you can go into the game and say, you know what, I can be a nice guy and people will enjoy me and they'll want to have me around and work with me in an alliance. I mean, that's me kind of projecting a little bit because that's how I felt at least as part of my game early on in my season. And also realize, geez, that's not working for me. I have to change it up. And I'm also actually mad. I got voted out. You know, so I don't think at any point I would call Rick Devens insincere. I'm more saying that if anything, being unfiltered prevents the notion of insincerity.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not the best barometer for that. I don't have that kind of discernment. I just know when I watch those tribal councils, like, oh, this is his, he clearly is thought this through how he's going to execute this, this vote. He's going to come out, he's going to come out swinging with his idol, talk about, you know, like, oh, you're going to try to embarrass me in front of my kids and like, oh, psych, I got my idol. Like he knows
that's right.
So, and I'll tell you, I can talk from firsthand experience, like the little speeches you give before you play your idol or whatever. I mean, you're in your head, you're like, you don't want to say something really stupid. So like in that time where the votes are being cast, you know, I remember I was kind of sitting there. I was like, okay, what am I going to say? Is that going to make sense? Okay. So you are workshopping it in your head. It's not like you're doing it's understandable that he would have at least mentally rehearsed what he's going to say. And the guy is a newscaster also. So he is, you know, very clearly knows how to dramatically present things that happen.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I'm just more commenting on the fact that he's now in a position where he doesn't have to he doesn't have to play nice, but I think it can also still be sincere when he's both being nice and being more confrontational.
Okay. I have so many questions for you from the listeners. Let's try to see how many of these that we can get into. Jessica Frey wants to know, who's playing a transformative game based on the Christian Hubicki scale? You said that Mike White in your season played a game that you felt like was a transformative game. Now, the people that that saw your season, the season 38 players did not. But that no. We can assume that we will have many people playing a very a Mike White game in season 39.
So when I said that about Mike, the sort of the transformative game, it had a lot to do with how he like just sort of systematically approached, you know, his strategy for the game as presenting himself in a certain way. That's a good question, because sometimes it's hard to tell from the airing of the show, because a lot of times it's the subtle things that you're like, oh, wow, in hindsight, that was really interesting and cool what that person did. I'm actually gonna say War Dog, because for a very, very specific reason, It's hard for me to say systematically, it was transformative. But like one very specific thing, when he got Kelly Wentworth out of the game, when he executed that blindside, okay, he talked about it in the sense of, here is how I executed that blindside. There's a beautifully edited sequence where they did a flashback of him going 30 second conversations, right? Of all of them. And so we had these short conversations and they put the blindside in place, didn't talk about it again. Now, is that specific move, has that never been done before? I doubt it. I'm sure it's been things like that might have been done before. I can't say for sure. Here's what I think is very important. If you are a Survivor player and you want to change how people play the game in the future, you need to present your work in a way that's compelling, that it gets shown on the show as interesting and a good strategy that hasn't been seen before. So when War Dog talked about how he pulled out that blind side, he was very descriptive. He was very, it was very pointed and very clear. And that allowed the show to very compellingly show how effective that strategy was. So now all these viewers, these 8 million some odd viewers, whoever watches the show, have seen, oh, if you want to blindside a great player, that's how you do it. Mm-hmm. Do it like that. So now by my definition of transformative, I said that while I was on the island, I didn't know what was said in confessional. So that's not a perfect mm-hmm. analogy for me. But like when I'm watching the show now, like you think about other things, other major moves that have played, that have sort of changed the game. And often it isn't the literal move itself. It is sort of how sexy it's sold mm-hmm. that really sticks with people.
Yeah.
So if you want to move the needle on how the game is played, then you have to present it in a way that the show has material to show it in a really interesting light. I mean, we can go back to even your first season, Rob. I mean, you played a different kind of game than we had seen in Survivor to that point, and it could have been but what if you never really explained it on camera in your interviews mm-hmm. when we're doing the confessionals, right? How would they portray your game? In actuality, when the show aired, people like Johnny Fairplay said they were inspired by your game, if I remember right. Am I remembering this roughly correctly? He said like he thought your game was really cool and that was a part of your game.
Yes.
And so I know you're probably, this is all complimentary towards mm-hmm. you, but I mean it sincerely that,
go
you know,
on.
Because
yes.
of, but do go on, but do on. So you changed, you in some degree transformed the game. But if you had never explained it, how would production ever show that you were playing something new and interesting? It probably would have been shown as, I don't know, Rob, he's doing something. He just goes wherever, which way the wind blows. And eventually they voted him out.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I think that a important part of transformation of the game is recognizing the fact that this will be aired on a television show, that even as crazy as a cool plan can be, if it doesn't stick with the audience, it won't resonate with the next generation of players. I think that it took a while for me to fully appreciate the 3-2-1 plan of Cerie Fields, mm-hmm. back in season 12. Back in season 12. I remember I watched it at the time and it kind of washed over me. But then on the rewatch, like years later, I was like, oh, wow. This is before I was ever plugged into the fan community to know that Ceree Fields was kind of like this, you know, this sort of vaunted player. And I watched it again. It's like, wow, that was really interesting. It took a second time for me. And I would need to watch Panama again for the umpteenth time to really get another sense. But when I wonder if that wasn't, if that had been sold more bombastically in the edit of the show, or maybe as to how Ceree like sold an interview. She did a good job, but if she was like, oh my gosh, I have like the best plan ever. I got these three thinking this one thing, these two thinking this other, and this one, it's amazing. And you sort of experience that moment with Ceree and you're like cackling with her. Then I think it would have stuck with audiences more. And you might've seen more things like 3-2-1s in the short time thereafter. Hmm. I try to remember the time, like when was the first time we saw a 3-2-1 after Ceree's 3-2-1? I know it happened in Cambodia. I know that happened with the Monica Padilla vote. My mental Rolodex is going through. It definitely didn't happen in China.
Yeah.
Definitely didn't happen in Fiji. Definitely didn't happen with Eric Reichenbach at all.
I'm sure we'll get it on Twitter.
Yeah, get on Twitter. Oh, thank you. That's right. I guess I don't have to do the mental research
online. That's
the
good thing. There are people fact-checking you as you speak.
So I look forward to Jeff Pittman's response to hear when the like 3-2-1 was. I know it happened with some people say it happened with Will Sims in Worlds Apart as well. But a long time is my guess. And I think so this all underscores my very long and belabored point that transformation in the game of Survivor in practice means you have to sell it. In less than 60 seconds and in a compelling way.
I do think that the biggest thing that I think that we'll see moving forward, I think that the tribal council antics that we've seen from this season, I do think that the first time we're going to get people playing who have seen this, I do think that we will see people being more ambitious, more bold with things that they're pitching in terms of like the pilots and passengers of like, hey, here's what I'm saying tonight. Okay. I say that this group of people, these three, I say we turn around and we vote out this person tonight. And that's what I'm saying, as opposed to being a little bit more vague, like we've seen of like, hey, there's going to be people who are going to, some of the stuff that David Wright was saying where, and ironically, he was the one that coined pilots and passengers. But I think in terms of like being like more direct of, OK, you, here's what we're doing tonight. OK, come with me. We're making this move tonight, and then having the tribal council be even more live.
I don't disagree with you. Here's a distinction I make. I think you're right that we will see more of it. For instance, after what was the first Whisper Tribal Council? That was JT and Game Changers. And so I think I'm sure, and that was one of the last seasons we saw in totality before we went out on 37. And Elizabeth started doing the Whisper stuff, right? So you started to see the Whisper game permeate. So, but did the Whisper game stick? I'm not convinced that it has. I'm not convinced that it has created. I mean, maybe at that Pilots and Passengers Tribal Council, because that was just so nuts. I mean, what else are you going to do other than, other than kind of sort of whisper to people? Mm-hmm. So I have no doubt that you're probably right. There will probably be some Devons-esque grandstanding at future tribal councils, and that's not meant to be demeaning toward it, but I think that he will be the one who's probably best known for it because he's the most lastingly dramatic,
especially if
performers.
He goes on to win the season.
Oh, if he wins the season, absolutely, we'll see a lot of it. The question, if it is in fact effective overall, which actually this is the thing, I don't know if it's effective. The reason that Rick can get away with this is because he's immune at these tribal councils. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you are not immune, I mean, that might be one of the reasons you don't see people like Aurora standing up in these hypothetical situations saying, this is me calling out people. But because she's worried the target will then switch to her at tribal council. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, Rick did help shift around that tribal council at the Pilots and Passengers. Who was immune at the Pilots and Passengers Tribal Council? I'm trying to remember.
I want to say it was it Gavin?
But it, but definitely wasn't Rick, right? Rick was not immune.
He had the immunity idol. He and David both had half of the immunity idol.
Right. So I was trying to make sure that he had to make an act. So Rick Devers was vulnerable at that tribal council, and he made a kind of a big move in terms of the how he handled the tribal council. I will say though, he was basically provoked into that.
Yeah.
Like you had Julia seemingly like attacking him, and what do you do other than respond at that point?
Yeah.
So I guess
he pitched something, and then she snapped back at him, and then I think that sort of like precipitated, like, boy, it really seems like Julia doesn't want us to do this thing. She seemed really upset about that, and that sort of just like got the action going faster. So, but I guess what I'm saying is that if somebody makes a verbal misstep at a tribal council, I wonder if that might not, we might see more players really trying to capitalize on that at a tribal council, and it goes from more of a verbal misstep, and that sort of happened in that with Elizabeth tribal council, where I think that Allison, because she called out Angelina about it seemed like she was trying to curry the jury, but and it seemed like that in the TV version, at least, that the tide was turning against Angelina at that tribal council. I wonder if we'll see more people getting the tide to completely turn over at these tribal councils based on what we see. And I think that more of the action might take place at tribal council than on the beach because of this season.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see that in the near future. Who's seen this? This would be everything
season
from 40 onward. 40 onward will have seen this. So that there's a good test. This is a testable hypothesis, Rob, as we'll start seeing it. I think you're probably right. We will probably see more of it. My question is, season 44 through 45, should we be so lucky? Are we still seeing it? Or do people realize that, hey, when the person who speaks up, like when they're not, when they grandstand and they're not immune, they tend to have like all it would take is someone in a Rick Devens-esque position or in some kind of position and stands up and grandstands, and all of a sudden they completely flat, they fall on their face, and then it becomes, oh, that person, they were fine until they decided to do this crazy thing. So we kind of overlearn.
But I don't think the person who is fine is doing the crazy thing.
Person is fine is doing the crazy thing. That's a good point. So that would take away. But it would be more like. Yeah, I guess because in both of those scenarios, so who are the people who would do a crazy thing? People who are perceived to be on the bottom and desperate people. And I think that was a big issue, by the way, with the Pilots and Passengers Tribal Council. It's very clear to Rick Devens and David Wright, they were on the bottom. They had nothing to lose. So that's what leads to these scenarios. So again, this is why if you are in the majority alliance, you don't want anyone thinking that they're on the bottom. I'm guessing at some point the ruse became too clear, that even if they tried to pretend to Devens and David that they weren't on the bottom, they probably sniffed it out at that point. So the desperate people are the ones doing the crazy moves. Either the desperate person goes home, at which point they're already desperate, so who cares? They're already gone, so it's not a big loss.
It's the Elizabeth, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Or they desperately and they sort of turn things around. I guess arguably that's what happened at the Pilots and Passengers Tribal Council. It got so crazy that he ended up taking out Julia. Was the target Kelly Wentworth? Or
Wentworth would have been voted out. We never really found out what the comma group was going to do, the reconstituted comma group. But I believe that the Julia and Gavin and Victoria and Aurora, I think also they were going to be voting out Kelly Wentworth. Kelly Wentworth was under the impression that the comma people were voting with her to vote out David Wright.
Well, let's play alternate universe. I know this is a little dangerous to play, but. So Devens wasn't going home, nor was David Wright at that tribal council. Rick Devens spoke up and tried to change up the game. How likely was it that during that whole craziness you had, that went down, people said, geez, that Rick, did you see how he just changed everything around? Let's vote him out instead. Is that possible? I'm completely speculating, but that would be a scenario where Rick spoke up. and paid and went home when he otherwise would not have. Now, I'm not saying by any sense it was a bad move. I'm just saying, are there search? I am questioning how effective in on average these moves would be. And or are they largely ineffective? Because if they're ineffective overall, people like they go by the wayside. I'm not sure we're going to see much whispering from here on out. Like just doing the tribal council whispering. I'm not. Has it ever been effective? I'm trying to think of a time.
The tribal council whispering, has it been effective?
Whispering. Yeah, has that ever been effective? Has that turned into like in the consensus mind of the viewer of, oh man, that person saved themselves because they went around and did the whisper game.
In terms of a save themselves situation, I'm not sure if it necessarily came to pass. In Heroes, Healers, Hustlers, when Lauren Rimmer went home, there was whispering going on. Everybody ended up casting their votes on Ben, but then he played an idol. So I'm not sure necessarily if the whispering would have saved somebody else. But I think it was probably always going to be Ben at that tribal council. So... yeah, you're right. The interesting question for me is also that if Kelly Wentworth would have just gone home at that tribal council, would that have been better for the David Wright and Devins group? Now, ultimately, Devin might win, so it's hard to say anything would be better for Devins.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, and you also have to be careful with the results oriented thinking on that. But even if he does win, it could have been, quote, a better move. But that's hard for us to say. But if I were to encapsulate this whole conversation of like what is transformative and like I think that so to my general point that you have to communicate it somehow on the screen in order to have a future impact for sure. Especially when it's an abstract idea. Definitely. And I think your point is very interesting that will we see in the near future more people grandstanding at tribal council? I think 40 on absolutely. Season 41, 40, 41, 42, I would bank on it. My question will be what sticks? What are the moves and techniques that stick? And those are the ones that sort of either have long-lasting impact in the viewers' minds or they're just effective. They become the new what we call metagame sometimes in gaming. Like, oh, this is the way people play the game now. It's now moved forward. And I don't know how effective it is, so it's hard for me to say whether it will stick.
Okay. Let me ask you this question from Jeffrey Goldstein, who says, could you, Christian, vote for someone to win that has been voted out of the game?
Oh, sure. In principle, yes. My thinking, like, so let's say I'm put in a position where I'm on the jury and someone like Rick Devins got voted off in the pre-merge and came back in the merge, right? Sure. Someone got voted out of the game. That's certainly, you have to take that into account, that they got voted out. But I have enough of a sort of random probabilistic view of the game, knowing that, look, you can't guarantee a win in this crazy game. It's just not possible. There are literal random factors. I mean, you can draw rocks at the point of the game, see who goes home or not. So you can't control everything. So what I would be assessing is, geez, yeah, that person got voted out early, but the game that I saw, how impressive was it? How much did they take their fate into their own hands? How much agency did they exert? And especially in a situation with Rick Devins, I mean, you can make a plausible argument for the notion of being swap screwed. I think it's a somewhat controversial notion, the idea that there are some times that you go into a swap, that you're dead in the water. I mean, you're in a tough spot. I think there are a couple clear examples. I think most people talk about Michelle Yee in Fiji.
Not a traditional swap, but yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's the most clear
draw.
Unlucky draw. I would say in terms of true, like a actual swap, I think the original Silas swap, I remember at the time I was writing down all the combinations that swap could have gone. The fact that they did a swap at that point for the first time and like almost every combination I think would have gotten him voted out of any swap that they could have done. So yeah, so there's some plausibility to that notion that That you can be screwed by a swap. And as, and that, and sure enough, Rick Devens got voted off at the first vote after that swap, and someone had to go. So I can be somewhat forgiving.
I will say that, to just push back a little bit on that, he was swapped with his exact tribe. Hey, so to say it was a swap screw situation, that basically it was his same exact tribe minus Big Wendy. So he had had an opportunity to sort of make those relationships.
Yeah, that's true. Here's the thing. And to be clear, I'm not claiming he was swap screwed. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that if I'm on the jury and I wasn't there on his beach, and you're saying, can you vote for this person who came back to the game? I might be sitting there thinking, oh, yeah, but it was a swap. That happens all the time. Swaps don't go your way. Now, with a God's eye view of the show, giving us the narrative of what happened. Oh, yeah, sure. These are people he had worked with since the first day. Right. Yeah. So if we could argue, quote, whether or not Rick Devens was swap screwed, that's a different argument that I'm making, to be clear, to the audience. So if I were to summarize my argument, it's that shit happens in the game. So like, and I can be convinced, like, you know, yeah, you caught a bad bounce on a certain thing. But given the suite of possibilities that could have happened in this game, and if I see in the merge, from the merge onward, I see really just impressive control of the game. I'm just like, geez, why can't I give you the $1 million? And I certainly understand the point of view, especially in this season where you didn't know that you'd come back from some Age of Extinction like thing when you got voted out. Like in any other season, Rick Devens would be gone and not around, right? So, so you could make the argument, of course, that, hey, you already lost the game. At which point, if you made that argument that if you lose as soon as you're voted out, that makes Edge of Extinction and completely pointless, which that you could make that argument, I guess. But I think there's something more important to say that, hey, here's the game. It throws twists at you. How do you best manage these twists, whether or not they're things like you come back into the game? And if you took advantage of this twist where you got thrown back into the game and you made the most of it, yeah, I could vote for you.
Mark Percy wants to know, how would you, Christian, have handled being on the Edge of Extinction, and would you have survived Reem? Meaning, would she have killed you for talking too much? That captive audience you would have had. What do you think? Would you have gotten along well with Reem on the Edge of Extinction?
I think yes. I mean, that's a dangerous thing to say, because a lot of times people go into watching a show and be like, oh, no one got along with this person, but I could. But and then
you're positive.
It's hard to be positive about anything. I got along with everyone on my team.
Are you?
Yeah. I mean, there is a unique, I think part of learning to work with all kinds of personalities, people who are like, even people who seemingly are incompatible, is just finding the way they operate. Like why does Reem find it annoying that you talk so much? So you sort of figure that out. You realize, like, oh, this is the bandwidth Reem likes. You can be adaptable in that way. I mean, and I understand the joke is somewhat in jest, but like, you know, I'm blabbering for, you know, we're well past two, we're like past 2.5 hours now, somewhere around 2.5 hours ish. Because you've given me permission to do so and invited me on your podcast. I blabbered for 5 hours because it was strategic, and what else was it going to do for all that time in front of Jeff Probst? And it would be fun. There is something to be said, especially when you're going on Survivor, you know, and you're stuck with this person who, in the best case scenario for you, is going to be on the jury when you go back into the game and voting for $1 million. You know, I'd shut up. I'd find a way. Do they have duct tape on Edge of Extinction? Maybe that's one. That's a surefire way, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's go to this question, and Edward Morris wants to know, Christian, how would you fix the auction? Okay. We didn't get into this when we did our last chat, right?
Right. So there's a couple ways. So the premise of the question is that the auction has been tabled for a while because it's, in my opinion, was basically hacked by Shireen by Shireen Askui when she said, "Hey guys, they're going to offer us letters from home. Everyone just bet $20, and then everyone will get a letter." And to my shock, Jeff Probst said, "Yes, that's exactly the rule." So I'm like, "No, they don't have to. You don't good on Shireen, but don't let the players, you know, don't let the inmates run the asylum here, Jeff. You know, you control this game. Don't let them game the system like this." So in general, the auction got gamed at that point. And also, people just hold out for an advantage. Mm-hmm. And so that makes the bidding for food less fun. And the argument against having the auction was that, oh, no one cares about people getting food anymore. I don't know. I'm not sure about that. I remember it was pretty funny when Wu had got his barbecue ribs and basically had essentially porn music playing to him eating them in mm-hmm. some kind of very like, so, but so I don't buy that, but there's
barbecue
one way.
Barbecue sauce, all tangy.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, that's a good impression. I actually thought you hit the button. It's like you had that button ready for that.
No.
It's pretty good. Your woo's pretty good. I guess you had like, what, you know, 14 hours of that evolution strategy thing to practice. Mm-hmm. So, I guess.
And the real time of, going through it. So
how would I fix it? Sorry. So, one way is to say off the bat, there are no advantages at this auction. And say you're only playing for food. And basically, it's an elaborate reward challenge where they're still picking up people to join you on various things of food. Just like, so you still have that, that social construct of people being annoyed at not being chosen for the reward, but it's in the context of the auction, which it's kind of funny because then you have better, you have what's most important on, I think, a survivor challenge, which is getting people to talk during them. I think that that's important. That's why the auction is one way of doing that. It gets people interacting in a spontaneous way. So that will get people interacting and actually bidding and not holding out for an advantage. That's one. Mm-hmm. Sorry, you were going to say something, Rob, before I interrupted you.
No, continue.
Yeah. So the number two is, how do you keep it in where there's still advantages in play? And that's trickier because you could announce up front that there is exactly one advantage up for bid. And in fact, you could do it right off the top, right? You could say, "It's Survivor Auction. I know what you're all thinking. There's an advantage." Well, guess what? There is. It's up for bid right now. It's the only one. So you either get it now and you can get it, or you can bid for it now and you lose out any chance for food in the future. And then what you do is you have the person who bids for the advantage, and then you have the drama of that person has the advantage, but they get to watch all these people gorge themselves on food that they auctioned for. And you still have all those same mechanics of like picking people, not picking people.
Hmm.
Those are the two ways that I would try it. What are your thoughts on that, Rob?
I wonder, could you have the advantage sort of like, one, do we need an advantage in the auction? Two, could you have the advantage be some sort of like a daily double where you don't know where it is? The advantage is going to come with something.
Yeah.
So get in the game, bid on the food. There might be an auction that's attached to something, or an advantage attached to something.
I like the daily double idea because then there's just an extra incentive to actually bid on things that isn't just right. Like, yeah, because, and if you announce that up front, it's like, guess what? You know, this is all food, but with one of these, it's going to be an advantage. Then people are betting all over the place. And then you still have the air in the balloon, as you like to say, throughout the whole tribal council. If you do it off the top, maybe that's a flaw in my idea. Then it's like, okay, advantage is done. Now fun food time. You know, maybe so the drama is let out. So this way you still have drama in that, associated with that. And then every time an item goes by without the advantage, the stakes get ratcheted up.
Mm-hmm. And what about this? And could you potentially, then if you win an item also, then you like, I want to see the survivors have some more animosity with each other. Could we do some sort of like a coconut chop challenge where then if you win, pick a person that's going to lose $100, where could we have some sort of like they have to also punish a person when they get an item?
You get a lot of thought to this, at least so it seems. I mean, for one, the coconut shop.
I haven't given a lot of thought to it. I just want to make it, make the survivors fight and create drama.
You need interaction. That's what's really important with these challenges. And unfortunately, and we can talk about the survivor challenges generally as sort of a jumping off point from this question. You want them interacting. So the effect of saying, hey, you do a coconut chop sort of deal or a rope chop where they lose $100, yeah, that would accomplish that and make people mad. And by the way, the reward challenge is the only time, in my opinion, that it's fair to have anything like a coconut chop. I'm glad that they stopped doing that for immunities. I did it a few times for immunities back in the first 10 seasons or so, mm-hmm. I remember, or at least, so I'm glad they don't do that. So the reward challenge would be a good place for that. So that would at least get people mad. You could also have the whole, it can be random and you can give someone $100 as well. I know you like animosity, but you can make it 50-50. Like you can make it randomly decide like, oh, you pulled the daily double. You know, you give a person $100. Then again, actually, I don't like that because then, you know, let's say you had to
collude.
No, you don't want them to collude. Well, the collusion is part of the okay. Well, depends on the collusion. It's one thing if it's the collusion that you did in Survivor Amazon that you talked mm-hmm. about in the Revolution Strategy, where you tried to
price
to
fix. Basically, yeah.
You tried to price fix the Survivor auction so that way it would be low prices. Then I think that the SEC, i.e., Jeff Probst,
yeah. Tried and to interfere with that. You, the survivors agreed to a plan that I believe Heidi came up with.
Oh, Heidi came up with this plan. Okay, that makes a little more sense. Okay, I can see that happening. But yeah, so that was the general so it wouldn't be in that. I mean, you want them to some degree. Maybe there's some collaboration because the idea is to reveal a pecking order, right? With these challenges, unfortunately, the strict pecking order challenges have also been gamed. The ones last time they did that in Blood vs. Water 2 in San Juan del Sur.
Yeah,
and they gamed the system and they killed it. And then they haven't done it since, if I remember. So,
Jeff shut it down.
Yeah. So you shut down the whole challenge. So, yeah. So this would be sort of like a stealth way to get back into that thing. Cause you can't have too much, sameness. Cause then I don't care what system you come up with, people will find a way to game it. So it's a good stealth way to work back in the coconut shop without people realizing it. Hey, people thinking, oh my gosh, we have a fun auction. In fact, mm-hmm. you can send them the envelopes in tree mail, say, guess what? Here's the money. And then you have all the players, they're getting together like, oh my God, I'm going to get all this food. And they're not thinking, and they might thinking, oh, I'll go for an advantage. They're not thinking what they probably want to think, what they should be thinking of, which is discussing beforehand, what order of coconut chop should we do?
Okay. Let's change this a little bit. Okay. Let's go all in on coconut chop challenge. Yes. Okay. And now you, instead of taking money away, because that's sort of like we're getting sort of artificial. So basically each survivor has like their auction table. It's sort of set up, but the three ropes are holding up like their like table. And then when the third rope gets chopped, their table drops. So you can't eat anymore.
Right.
At the point that you get chopped.
Yeah, I can see John Kierhofer at all having a blast making these tables that will just literally drop the food away from them.
It just drops. So you can get, oh, $500, plate of spaghetti. Oh, great. Garlic bread. All right. And then the next person goes, chop, chop, chop. And now my food just completely falls on the floor. It's like, you guys are a real bunch of jerks. I didn't get to finish that.
So I'm imagining people cramming their food down as fast as possible. Basically, it's a West Nail eating chicken nugget eating challenge, mm-hmm. effectively at these things. People trying to scarf down all this food.
Yes.
I will say
there's no utensils either. There's no maybe there's like we're making it like really difficult. Also, like there's no utensils, and so it's like a plate of spaghetti, and now that you need time, and now we're chopping people.
So the best challenges, I mentioned before, they have interaction between the characters. So you get character moments. You understand what the motivations are, but also ones where people at home think about how they would have done the challenge. And here's an example I actually really like. In Hustlers, that's really hard to say. Am I the first person that's pointed out that it's really hard to say that title?
I think so.
Am I the first person? Okay, I'm not the first person to point that out. Season 35, but the spaghetti reward challenge, right? I remember thinking about how would I handle the spaghetti challenge.
That was a good one.
Yeah, I liked it. I remember I complimented Jeff on the Spaghetti Reward Challenge during my 5-hour challenge. I said, yeah, by the way, Jeff, I was a big fan of the Spaghetti Challenge. I'm glad you did it. And you talked about how they tested it out and everything. And he says they test out a lot of stuff. I remember.
No doubt.
So anyway, but I love that because I had to think about how would I handle it. And so you got to see this cool progression of like people not realizing there was the clue there, then realizing there was the clue there, and then trying to cover up the plate with a napkin, then trying to get the clue under the plate out, and Ryan eventually just hit it off in the woods somewhere. And so that was interesting. It got me thinking about how I would do that. So when you have this challenge with this table, with all this food coming at them, you might have like weird food, like when you have like things that are kind of hard to eat, like chicken wings are a little bit hard to eat. Then you start giving people like elaborate foods, like that would be like, how the heck do you eat this? Like, maybe like, I don't know if anyone's ever had Maryland blue crab. Mm-hmm. Where you actually pick the crab apart. It's a very delicate process where they give you a knife and a mallet. I grew up in Baltimore, so this is a delicacy in the area. So like the things that are like, okay, I have to eat this food, and you have people like it's, and you have the comedy of people trying to pry this apart, while someone, you know, smashes their rope. I think that I like that idea. So, and also, you know, fairly low budget, you make these tables, that you chop the rope and they drop. And then all the plates smash. It's very dramatic.
Yeah.
In fact, I remember even of the chopping rope challenges, I remember like they'd have like the masks made up as the different survivor players.
Yeah.
And they smashed them. I remember Amanda Kimmel going, this is so violent. And I'm like, it was mm-hmm. great.
And nothing makes survivors more mad than messing with their food.
Oh, yeah. I think that's a good way. And so you're bidding on food that you're going to eat at this auction table. And when you get food, you also get to chop a rope.
You have to chop a rope. Yeah.
Exactly. You must chop a rope. You have to take the choice away from them. They have to choose. They have to do that. I think a lot of times where Survivor, they sometimes get tempted to like let survivors have their way. I remember there was the auction in, Steven's season, Token Sheens, where they sort of just like let everyone have their loved ones. Mm-hmm. You know, there needs to be a conflict stakes. In the decision.
Yeah. And maybe it's exactly. Two ropes instead of three, because it's sure. you know they got to get to a lot of auction items, but you know, two ropes. And maybe it's like now it's like really wobbly to be able to, like, if you have no utensils, you have to like only use your mouth. Now it's like harder to eat because the table is shaking now because of the support structure has been compromised.
There's a lot. This is one of those good ideas, you know, because you're like spinning all these interesting maybe the table's tilting a little bit. You know, guess what? You don't get to chop a rope, but you get to like tilt their table. You get to rock it around a little bit, you know, or something like messy. You know, this is something that you could try a whole bunch of ideas. Dream Teamers, if you're listening and are trying this, you are free to use this idea, but you must film yourselves doing it and put the footage on the internet.
Okay? No, don't give the ultimatums to the
ultimatums.
Dream
Team. Oh, yeah. Okay, all right. I get that. I just want to be a fly on the wall.
We're almost 3 hours into this. We're lucky if anybody's listening, let alone the Dream Team.
Oh, are we 3 hours? Oh, dear God. Okay. Yeah. So, but yes. But my point being, I would love to be a fly on the wall. For them when they're testing out this challenge. So if you're listening, which you're not, Dream Team, at least, you know, if I bump into you, just report to me what that experience was like. And hopefully it's more of like a pleasant, fun experience, not like, Christian, why'd you make us do that?
Mm-hmm.
So that'd be good. Okay. Anyway.
All right. This is a question from Swaggy J, who says, as a brochacho expert, I was wondering if Christian could help me rank the following Edge of Extinction contestants from no chacho to brochacho, okay, with brochacho being the brochachiest. Okay. Could you rank these gentlemen? We have Chris Underwood.
Okay.
Joe Anglum, Eric Hafeman, the War Dog, Ron Clark, and Gavin.
Okay, so in this, so whenever you're ranking anything, you need objective
some snubs
metrics.
Here. David Wright, not mentioned in the.
That's a little snub. If I could be a brochacho, I believe also David Wright can make mm-hmm. it into the running.
And Gavin, in the game, he gets in consideration. Rick Devin's in the game, not in consideration for a brochacho. Okay.
So I'm sensing some selection bias in terms of the field here, but I believe you have to measure this based on your adherence to the rules of the brochachos.
Yes,
which were I believe number one, your hair must be always be on point.
Yes. All right. So maybe that's why David Wright was disqualified.
Maybe. Or like, you know, what can he do with his hair?
The war dog is here.
Yeah, that's true. So, I mean, like maybe relative to its all possible hair states, you know, he cannot be bad because his hair is in exactly the same state as it would be if it were both on point or not on point. So it's a very collapsed sort of state of the hair. So hair must be on point. I mean, Gavin, I believe, styles his hair quite nicely. Mm-hmm. I was actually consistently in violation of rule number one. I think I was on Brochacho probation for a little bit. We actually talked about this in one of the challenges in David versus Goliath, the first reward challenge after the merge, where we're all holding sandbags over our heads for a pizza reward. You can see I'm next to Allison in that challenge, and we come up with this strategy of holding the bags by helping each other hold the bags. Like we sort of make like a teepee, like a triangle, mm-hmm. With, you know, where we're each holding up like at an angle, our arms at an angle, holding up multiple bags. So we're basically like looking into each other's eyes during this challenge, and so like, you know, we're chatting, and at one point like Dan talks about the rules of brochachos, and he was like, Christian, what's the rules of the brochachos? And I start saying all the rules of the brochachos, including the fact listing the ones I was in current violation of. And Allison told me I had to stop because I was going to make her laugh and drop the bags. But yeah, so rule number two is one must maintain your mad skills, I believe. I forget the order. So the mad skills maintenance is very important. So in that sense, I know that Chris Underwood was catching fish.
His
mad skills. So we have evidence of the mad skill maintenance, mm-hmm. in this case. So he's, I think, is right up at the top with the maintenance of the mad skills. Somewhere on the list also is doing pull-ups every day. I have not seen evidence of pull-ups being done at Edge of Extinction. So I have to do an incomplete for everyone. On those grounds. Also, the word brochacho has to be used as a substitute for every noun. Also adjectives, as well. So you can use brochacho as an adjective as well. It's a ubiquitous sort of word. So no evidence on those grounds too. So I have to go on the hair and mad skills. So, I've seen evidence of mad skills by Chris Underwood. Has Joe been catching fish while he's out there, or is he been mad skilling?
It has not been part of the show. If he has,
okay, all right. So we have, but I have to go on based on the evidence I have. So I think I got to go default. I got to go. Chris Underwood is at the top. And Gavin's on the list too.
Gavin's on
so
the list.
His hair is I would say on point in that it's very intentionally crafted in that way. It seems. I mean, this is no shade on Joe's hair. He rides that line where I don't know if his hair is done in sort of like an intentionally messy way, or if this is just like, I don't care. I imagine it's probably the former.
The
it's probably intentionally. Yeah. So that's good. I mean, in a way that's its own style, but clearly Gavin is putting himself out there as hair that is intentionally on point. So he's up there. In terms of the other brochachos, who's left? Who's the no chacho? That's a hard one to say because I mean, everyone who has not demonstrated on point skills, or has really not intentionally done a lot with their hair, it's hard to tell. It's hard to say. Did we talk to Wardog at all at Engine of Extinction? Did we talk to him?
We saw a brief shot of his letter, and there was a deleted scene or secret scene of him arguing with Reem.
Okay. I don't remember any brochacho arguing with Reem in the past. Mm-hmm. So therefore, I think that's going to put, unfortunately, that's going to be the brochacho.
Are you eating a brochacho?
So yeah. So that's my
ranking. Do you even have mad skills? You know what? I have mad skills. That's my number one skill, being mad.
I'm assuming it's been pointed out, Rob, that like on what a rarity it has a character like Reem gets. We see her every episode of a season of Survivor,
yes.
Virtually.
Right. I don't know if we've seen her necessarily, like, other than being on the jury. We've seen her every single time out.
Yeah.
But
sure.
You know that. I mean, she really has had like the punctuation on every single episode, seemingly these last few weeks.
Yeah, the jury, they seem pretty hammy to me this season, I'm getting a lot of big reactions from the jury. I don't think I'm the first one to point this one out either. I wonder if this is in fact true. in part due to, like, what else are they going to do? This is the most entertaining thing they have, you know.
I mean, you nailed it earlier. Like,
yeah. Okay. Yeah, cool.
They've got one channel, and it's it's Tribal Council.
Exactly. Oh, those poor people. I feel for you all.
Okay. Billy wants to know, if there are two Edge of Extinction players in the final three, do you think that that was a good or bad result for this season?
I think that any time that the theme plays out through the whole season, that all other things being equal, that's good. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't want to go through this whole experience of, you know, this experiment of Edge of Extinction, and Edge of Extinction to be completely pointless, in my opinion. I mean, like, and that's sort of one of the things that was a little frustrating with the Redemption Island seasons. It's not just that in any given Redemption Island season, the Redemption Island person didn't come back and get into the finals. It was just that they never did. And in fact, my biggest problem, probably one of the biggest problems for Redemption Island, was that whoever comes back from there is just an enormous target. They got time to just talk to all these people without having to scheme against them, who are going to be on the jury. So, like, that was always a bit frustrating, at least when Redemption Island would go all the way to the end of the game. Yeah. I know you've talked about the idea of stopping it at the merge or things like that. I think that's pretty reasonable. I remember you saying that, and I was thinking, yeah, that's a good idea. The only thing is that then I was worried about incentives, about keeping around people who are good at challenges. I don't remember if that's true. That should be old. Anyway, I'm sorry. That's a half-baked thought. But that's a decent idea. So here, you have all these players who stuck around for what day are we on the game? Is it day 34, 35?
Yeah, I think 36? It's 34.
34? 34 days. Rima's on that island for a month, and up, and now she's gone. And same for everybody else. So I think it's fine if you have at least one representative in the final game.
It's fine. You know what, dude? It's fine.
And if it's two, that's okay. I think if a person who was on Edge of Extinction basically the whole game came back and won, that's tricky. That's where it starts to feel like there was this whole game happening on the island that was really interesting. And all these people were, like, you know, plotting against each other, and they're flipping on alliances, and none of it matters.
Yeah.
Then it devalues that whole game. So you want a balance. So if you had a player in the final three, that's fine. That's fine. Yeah. If they ran away with it, I would be like, that would annoy me and be like, wait, so how much did you care? It would be one thing, like if it's Rick, right? Rick got to come back and he clearly played a game. You know, you got to see his game.
Yeah.
Rick
missed either, you know, 5 or 6 days being on the Edge of Extinction.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, Rick was only gone for a short period of time. So that makes sense.
Yeah, if somebody came back, like, where Joe came back and missed the entire post-merge and then came back and won, I think that that's more of a problem for the show. The same way where Ozzy, where it looked like if Ozzy got to the end in South Pacific, he was going to win the game. And he had basically been on Redemption Island for the entire post-merge of that season.
So, yeah. So if you miss an entire post-merge, that's hard. Because, like, I remember when I was judging, like, the players from the jury standpoint, I felt I could only judge people based upon their post-merge games. I basically pretended like the pre-merge didn't happen from that standpoint. So you miss that entire game on the island. That's problematic. And a reason why I would be... It's always so problematic when you bring in someone right at the very end of the game. For one, they are not there. If they're not there for, like, almost the whole merge. And two, when they come back so close to the end, they're like this blinding target. In fact, like, it might be the best thing that ever happened to Rick Devons, that someone's coming back from Edge of Extinction. So if someone threatening comes back from Edge of Extinction, like a Joey Amazing, then that would be a certain thing. Like, that'd be one of the few situations where Rick Devons might be spared. And that's the only thing I could think of. So in a way, that's sort of helpful for the threats still in the game. I mean, I'm sure Boston Rob was, to some degree, annoyed that people are coming back from Redemption Island, but at least he could rally the troops against them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's my thinking. Yeah.
Okay. Do you have a pick for who's going to come back from the Edge of Extinction?
Oh, I do not have a pick. There are 11 people that are going to be there. So, and all are fairly distributed. They're going to try to edgic the situation. So
edgic of extinction.
Edgic of, oh, I see what you did there. It's very clever. And the, I don't know. Like, I'd be surprised if it was like a Julia. Yeah. We did get an emotional moment from her to, in this most recent episode. I would have said like a Joey Amazing. Maybe let me answer your question with a question, Rob, which I know is always annoying. But the who has a story on the edge of extinction that would be satisfied by coming back and potentially winning? Who does? I mean, what have we gotten from people? We've gotten actually one that I remember is Chris Underwood, him saying that he is like he thought he could play a perfect game, but he has to reconcile with the fact that he didn't play a perfect game and now has to soldier on from there. We haven't seen a whole lot of him. David Wright, I mean, we haven't seen much of him recently. Aubrey was fighting for those advantages, but it's not really a story more than it is scrappiness. Kelly Wentworth said something when she got voted out with that. What did she talk about? She talked about what it's like to be voted out.
Yeah.
Normally you get food and this time you don't. But like, I'm trying to struggle, like, what is the story of whoever comes back to win?
That's why I think it's going to be Aurora who comes back.
I can see the story reasoning for that. Because then she also, that would be frankly pretty entertaining. I mean, it's not.
Because it doesn't feel like any of the people that are there are coming back.
Yeah, that
except
would be
Rain.
Pretty. Yeah.
Could you imagine? Even if she came back for one vote, how great would it be?
I was just going to say.
Reem comes back. And then I guess we consider her. She's the sixth place finisher on the season, right?
Yeah. I mean, well, that's another thing. People talk about what are the season placements for the season? I mean, obviously, I'm guessing there will be a lot of ties. So the couple of scenarios. One is that they just go based upon the order of which they're voted out, unless they got brought back into the game, which in this case, Reem will be the sixth place player of the season for sure. But what about all these other players? Whenever they had the final, a lot of times when they ever had the final Redemption Island duel, they would do a duel with when it would be a Trool or a Cool with multiple players. They'd always do a challenge that you would drop out first and not just who would win. Because I thought it's for some reason because for no small part, because then you could assign technically a placement to people who did worse or best in that challenge and therefore a placement for the season.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe they'll do that, or maybe just the tiebreaker would be like an order of who got voted out first. But yeah, you're right. Whoever comes back from this Edge of Extinction, even if it's Reem, there are at least a sixth place player.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that
even
this
if
what
Reem
I mean
comes
by
back and gets
experience.
Voted right out? It would what? How great,
dude? Could you imagine?
Which of those interactions would be the most interesting? So where was anyone? So the only who was there who voted her out? Technically,
Devins.
It was Lauren, Devins and Lauren,
mm-hmm.
Right? Devins, Lauren, and that's it, right? So I think that, and also who in she who is she always rooting for? She liked Joe and was mad that Joe got voted out at the merge, if I remember Reem, right?
Yeah.
So I'm trying to remember, like, who does Reem like? I imagine that's not a super long
Ron
list.
Clark.
She liked Ron Clark. Okay. So, mm-hmm. And she's not, and he's not coming back in with her, nor is Joe. So I just wonder if she'll gravitate toward anyone, which might be the best solution for the show, of course.
Yeah. She would pile on of like, you know what? I've had it with Devins. I'm tired of this guy. He voted me out. Screw you, Devins.
Yeah, she would definitely go after Rick Devins as if he needed more people going after him on the season.
Like,
but still,
see, everybody's out to get me, jury.
See, even Reem was like, well,
even Reem.
Oh, could you imagine the reaction of the Edge of Extinction people if Reem was the one who went back in?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm just,
she's because, a champion.
Well, here's another question. If Reem comes back into the game, do people like, are people look, would people looking to take her to the end? I guess the people,
I think it would be at their own peril. I really do. I think that the jury would vote for her, and I think that people would look at her and say like, well, she's a first boot. I'll take the first boot to the end with me. She's an easy vote. Maybe, she's a goat.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what probably, yeah, the question for me was, would they be tempted to? Because they don't know kind of Reem like we, like the audience knows Reem. I mean, how much interaction have, who are the four people, the three people who have had no interaction? Well, it's, go on.
I would just say that I think that the one problem, though, with this scenario is that I don't know how well Reem would hold up to jury questioning, where I think that she would very likely get a question from the jury, perhaps like a Kelly Wentworth and something like, you know, Reem, you were the first boot in this season. Why should I vote for you to win this game?
Screw you, dude.
Yeah, I was just going to say, is a screw you is going to be the answer. Almost literally, I would expect that. And so that's why it's like, I wonder, like, if you have people who like left in this game, who is worried about their position with the jury? I mean, everyone's worried about Devin's, which makes sense. But like, and it seems like Gavin feels like he's in a good position to win for his story. I don't know where Julie thinks she stands, other than she feels like she's on the bottom right now. But I don't know where, like, is Victoria worried about her standing with the jury relative to knows? People she go to the end of? I guess we don't know. I mean, anyway, I'm sorry. I think it would be an interesting question if I had more information on it, but it's hard because I like to ponder the scenario where this is, you have Reem come back into the game who, by the way, Victoria, Gavin, and Julie don't know from Adam. Mm-hmm. She comes back in. Oh, here's Reem. Here's this person, probably little, you know, kooky, got voted off first, and they probably have no idea. I guess Rick Devins could say what she's like. Mm-hmm. Rick Devins is probably the one who's the only one able to report what she was like on the edge. But yeah, but I imagine them like one of them maybe taking them to the end as a goat. And I was curious if they'd be tempted to. That's what I'm thinking about. And if they were, that would be a phenomenal finish. I don't think that's likely. I think that someone like Reem, how does she fit in strategically if she comes back into the game? Or
it's fun to talk about, but I think there were probably not the best use of our time here.
No, go ahead. We can move on. Okay. I take the signal.
All right. Let's power through a couple more questions. Jennifer Jones wants to know, is War Dog good at math, Christian?
Yes.
He is. Okay.
It's pretty good. Oh, I had rewatched that scene because, he's a smart guy. So I was thinking about, I trying to quote this in my head. I tried to memorize what he said. So he was talking about the odds of all of the Lesu players being drafted together. All the six, there were six remaining Lesu players at that time, I believe. So it was 9 and 6. So 15. So split up into three tribes. I'm not sure if War Dog is fully right. If he did this for my class, I would give him a ton of partial credit at the very least, most of the credit. So what are the odds that of the six remaining Lesu members?
Let me give you the quote. Okay.
You have the quote?
Yeah. Okay, here's War Dog.
Never happened. That's in the odds of that.
Much less than 1%. Because it's like you just take a constant and you multiply 4 to 14, 3 out of 13, 2 out of 12, 1 out of 11. You multiply that 4 times.
Yeah.
And that's a percentage. It's less than 1%. I was kind of doing the math in my head.
Yeah. And let me say, first off, brave of War Dog to do math on national television when you have no calculator and you're starving on an island. Because if you're wrong, you look kind of dumb. So I admire his bravery in doing so. And so, yeah, what he's talking about is that, what are the odds of getting all the Lesu, five of the six Lesu on a tribe of five? The way he's talking about it is that you take 4 out of 13, 4 out of 14. Yeah. So I think it was like 5 out of 14, whatever he said. It's not quite right in my opinion, but it's close enough where the odds are that for the first slot of new Lesu tribe members, there is a 6 out of 15 chance that slot would have to be filled with a Lesu member. Okay. Because there are six, original comp, not commas, Manu.
Yeah.
Manu. There are six original Manus out of the 15. Okay. Then you take one of the Manus off the board, and then you have four more slots that you have to fill. And now only 14 total players. So now you have 6 out of 15 times 5 out of 4, It's 5 out of 14 times 3 out of 13 times 2 out of 12 times 1 out of 11. That's very close. Oh, sorry, 3. I messed up the numbers ever so slightly. But you have to count down from 6, I think, because there were 6, including Wendy, instead of the 5 he was counting down from, I'm pretty sure. So, but that general progression of the math is right. So I give him a ton of credit.
Okay. How did you feel about Wendy? And did you feel like that you were prophetic when you said
the chicken has flown the coop?
Actually, I believe the beach where she let the chicken fly the coop was, in fact, the David beach I was on when I said that. Okay. So I think so. So in some ways, I take some credit. Yeah, I'm sure that that's been talked about. But man, that is you can tell that production wanted to talk about. They wanted to show a lot of Wendy while they had her. that's pretty clear, man. Like the whole pre-merge felt like this whole story of Wendy and the chickens. And like when I think about it in hindsight.
Okay.
So yeah, there's a lot of it.
Trying to see what else I have for you that we haven't touched on. Brendan Fitzpatrick has a question for you he wants to know, can you give us your best tribal council metaphor about how Survivor is like robotics?
Or
Survivor like a Reuben sandwich?
Survivor's like a Reuben sandwich. So we can try both. So let's try the Survivor. It's kind of like robotics. So did you talk about Tribal Council specifically or Survivor generally?
No, Survivor. You would say this Survivor. Is a Tribal Council.
Yeah. So in Survivor, so in robotics, you typically have a task that you're trying to do, which is like move a pallet, you take a robot and move a pallet across a factory or get a robot to go and pick up a coffee for you. But there's so many variables in how you get to that end. And so many unknowns, you don't know if there's going to be a person blocking your way, it's going to be a curb in your way. So how are you going to get around all of these obstacles? How are you going to handle all these unknowns to go accomplish your task? And it's not always clear what you do in the near term in order to get there. Does your robot, does it take the stairs? Does it take the elevator? There are lots of decisions to make, just like there are a lot of decisions in Survivor that have to take into account all of these future risks to accomplish your goal, which is to maximize winning the game. That's my quick top of the head metaphor. For a Reuben sandwich, Survivor's like a Reuben sandwich. A lot of people think that it should have sauerkraut on it, and that is not necessarily true.
Okay. And that's also like Survivor.
That's also like Survivor. I was going to try to make an Aubrey coleslaw reference, but I realized that's coleslaw and that's sauerkraut. So that fell completely on its face. So I'm glad that they have an edit button at Tribal Council where, they took out my worst metaphor, okay. Which is good. So
Christian, what else do you want the listeners to know about? Any other thoughts on this season?
Well, I had a whole thing. I'll say overall state of Survivor. I think it's in generally in good shape. I think a lot of people are kind of bent out of shape about the storytelling of the season. But I'm actually really optimistic because I see I see the passion behind what I see is coming together in the show. And I think that's most important, that that as long as there's a passion there for it, all it takes is to get the concept and to mesh well with exactly what's happening on the island. And it's every season is a little bit of a roll of the dice as to how things work out in terms of the overall story structure.
I do think there's a little bit of a disconnect. I think that there's a loud minority very unhappy with this, but I think if you went and talked to the average Survivor viewer, sort of like if you're polling like a cross section of the 7.5-8 million people that watch the show, I don't think that they are particularly up in arms about this season.
No, they're not up in arms. I talk to when I run into people on the street who happen to recognize me, they ask me what I think of the season. It's like, I think it's a fun experiment that they're going for. That's what I tell them. And they're like, I'm enjoying it. Mm-hmm.
And my mom, who is the biggest Joey Amazing fan, I think that she's come around on Joe not winning this season and is overall that she's invested in the outcome.
these are not the darkest days. I think people need to, I think that on Twitter, a lot of the, of course, the loudest voices will rise to the top, and at least basically on my timeline and stuff. That's not to say that, you know, of course, that, you know, could there be better decisions made on some level? I mean, I'm not going to argue that, that they can't. It's just it, like, I think that it's easy to forget that there was a time where, like looking back, like we're lucky. I think we have Survivor after season 24. In my opinion, there were times where I felt like the show didn't quite know what they wanted to mm-hmm. do in the future. And then how much of a revelation Survivor Philippines was.
Yeah.
That was amazing. I loved it. I mean, it was just such a the show always finds a way to like really kind of keep going. And I think that that's a testament to the fact that there are people who really care who are putting it together. That's my thought on the health of the show. And I'm really curious to see what they have, what they come up with moving forward, what kind of lessons they learn. Cause I mean, I'm sure it's been pointed out how interesting these shots they've done, like these editing tricks, they're doing more of like the genius style editing where you could we flash back into the past or people are enjoying putting the show together, and you can tell, and that's the best indicator I think you can have for a show like this.
Okay, Christian, what a thrill this has been for me to go into everything. This time has flown by today.
Oh, great.
I really appreciate you taking some time away from all of your work and your teaching to talk to us. Can you give us a little update on what you're up to with work?
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. So I signed the paper right before I went on Survivor. I signed the paperwork to become a professor at Florida State University in the Florida A&M Florida State University College of Engineering. I'm a mechanical engineering professor, which means I run my own research laboratory into walking robots. And I teach classes on control systems. So so we have in our laboratory this, walking ostrich. Its name is Tallahassee Cassie, its name. And it walks around. It can walk up like unseen obstacles. You can give it pushes and it'll recover. And the goal is to understand how we make these robots walk around in a more sort of efficient and stable way so that we can have them get around in our environments. And more importantly, whenever we learn something about how to program these robots, I learn a lot about how people walk around. And that's important for understanding how to help people who have lost the ability to walk or are impaired in their ability to walk, to help walk them again, help make them walk again with things like robotic, like prosthetics or robotic exoskeletons that you can sort of scrap them into to help them walk. So that's sort of my research program that I've been developing. So right now I have my lab, and so we have this cool robot where it's pretty neat. You can check out our work, at optimalroboticslab.com. It's called the Optimal Robotics Lab. And, we have a lot of fun students that are working on some cool projects.
All right, Christian, thank you so much. I look forward to hopefully doing this again in the future if you are up for coming back.
I'm happy to do so. And thank you for having me this time. I look forward to a fun finale.
And I can speak for the listeners who I know, especially the ones that are listening at this point in time. They really appreciated you making all this time. And I know that the listeners will probably let you know on Twitter as well. But we really are. I know how busy you are. So this means a lot to all of us that you spent so much time talking about all this stuff today, because we had some real fascinating conversations.
Oh God! I thank you so much, and it is fun to be here. It's fun to talk about this stuff, and I'm glad that there's an audience for it. And I won't take up too much of your time. I mean, it's cool when people like kind of stop you on the street and talk to you, like, oh, I remember you from the show. A lot of times you get similar questions, right? You know, like, oh, was it hard out there? Do you actually not eat?
Right.
You know, did you, you know, where do you go to the bathroom? It's probably very typical. When you get questions like, did you survive? I have about five comebacks I've prepared for that.
Cause I need one.
I didn't. Jeff Probst killed and ate me. That's not very good. I don't use them. I never use these comebacks, but I have them in the back of my head, but I never actually do that. I'd like, you can do a sarcastic one if people are like really mean, but I'm never like, most people, they just don't know what to say, mm-hmm. right? They that's the whole point. They're like, oh, they think Survivor is cool. And they don't know that
it's not necessarily the person who knows from Survivor. It's like somebody has like anecdotally introduced you as like, yes. Oh, this is Christian that he was on Survivor. And then the person who knows nothing about Survivor is the person that asks you, did you survive?
Yeah, exactly. Because that's all that's all I can come up with in the moment. And what else? Because
the person
that
saw your season has questions about your season. It's the person that has no idea what Survivor is that asks, the annoying questions.
Exactly. And that's and it's fine. You get good at answering those, but it's really fun to come on and have people ask sort of in-depth questions about the season, because you're not going to talk to a random stranger. Yeah. It's like, no, you don't understand about the Elizabeth vote. There was this cool thing and blah, blah, blah. They don't care.
Yeah.
So this is fun.
Okay.
Thank you guys very much.
Well, Christian, thank you so much. You could follow at C Hubicki on Twitter. Do you have a hashtag for the listeners?
Oh, what's the thing we talked about? What was the there's something we stumble across this for a hashtag that kept coming back. I'm sure we talked a little bit about War Dog Math.
Mm-hmm.
I talked at the beginning a lot about. Jeez, I'm the worst at these. Last time it was chest hair because that was my anecdotal thing that I brought up from the season. how about the hashtag entropy? Because Amanda Rabinowitz brought that up. It's not too hard to spell ENTR.
And it's also a good describing word for this podcast.
That's very true. It's very disorganized in my part.
Yeah.
So thank you. Yeah.
So I want to encourage everybody to make sure you subscribe to the podcast feed, because we still have a lot coming up. We have Mike Bloom, new dad. Mike Bloom is going to be my guest on the Survivor Feedback Show. So be on the lookout for that. Make sure you get your Survivor Feedback questions in for my podcast with Mike that I'm recording on Saturday. And then Shannon Gates will be my guest. Of course, she is our lead anchor for our international Survivor coverage. She's going to be my guest on Twitch. Do you follow any of the international Survivor, Christian?
I watched a little bit of Survivor
South Africa.
South Africa and a little bit of Australia.
Yes, Survivor South Africa is coming back next week with that its new season is going to coincide with the end of American Survivor. So we'll have plenty of Survivor to talk about this summer, and we'll get into everything with Shannon Gates on This Week in Survivor, along with Jordan Kalish. And then we will have the final wiggle room of the regular season, where one more person will win an entry into the final wand off with our friend Josh Wiggler coming up on Monday. And then I will be at the finale on Wednesday night, but Stephen Fishback and Hannah Shapiro will have the Survivor Know-It-Alls for you live after the episode. And then I will have my interviews with the final six and eventual winner of Survivor: The Edge of Extinction. Do you want to make a call on that?
I'm going to go Julie is my call.
It's Julie. That's a little off the board.
It's a little off the board. I really don't have a good read on this season. Certainly it would be a wonderful surprise to me if like Rick Devens came through. I worry he's the kind of guy that might just fall just short. But congratulations to him if he makes it through. I think the fact that Julie is kind of working with him a little bit is an interesting tell. I find that from a storytelling standpoint, she is sort of befriending the hero in terms of a storytelling point.
Yeah.
That's my,
I will say that what an interesting turn of events that would be, because I feel like that all signs are pointing to Rick. Mm-hmm. If Rick goes on to not win the season, that I just do think in terms of his social media life, I think is a much different story of that. If he becomes the you should have won guy, as opposed to the, you know, loud minority on Twitter coming for him, talking about what a bad winner he is, that it's a, you know, a different story for his bank account, but a night and day on social media.
Yeah, I'm not sure he would like that trade, to be honest. I imagine I would want the million too. But yeah, that's my weird off the board take.
Okay. All right. Of course, for the patrons of Rob is a Podcast, plenty more in store for you all, because we've got our patron podcast feed. I'll have our Facebook Friday coming up this weekend as well, and everything that is going on behind the scenes over at robhasawebsite.com/patron. If you want to become a member of our Survivor community, if you love talking about this stuff as much as Christian and I do, that's the place for you. Rob has has a website.com/Patreon. Christian, thank you again so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on your show. And you have a wonderful end of the season, okay?
Okay, and you too. Thanks so much to Scott St. Pierre for putting this all together. Take care, everybody. Have a good one. Bye.
Bye-bye. You program robots, solve algorithms. You are actual elite. They called you Big Bang and Cochrane Plus Plus. Interface to Gabby. Your code is flawless. You've got good BIOS. If kernel panic, then go. On Charm Offensive, like R2-D2, not that whip 3PO. I want you to know, you're not 3PO. You hang with John and Dan.
Equal, you are their equal.
You lead like Iron Man.
People, you lead your people.
Upgraded to Green Buffs.
Sequel, you query sequel.
The head of awesome stuff. You are a Rochacho, Mr. Roboto. You are a Rochacho, Mr. Roboto. You are a Rochacho, Mr. Roboto. You are a Rochacho, Mr. Roboto.
Ambassador Rochacho, Mr. Roboto. You're integrated sentient, not compatible. System must capture, Mr. Roboto. The coming shall again. It's hot, swappable.
Rochacho, Mr. Roboto.
You're unstoppable.
You're phenomenal.
You're
phenomenal.